Going to go ahead and begin the meeting now.
Okay. I'll take roll.
Roll call poll.
Regent Carver.
Here.
Regent Carvalho.
Here.
Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Here.
Chair Dubrava.
Here.
Regent Geddes.
Here.
Regent Hayes. Regent Levine.
Here.
Regent McAdoo.
Here.
Regent McMichael.
Here.
Regent Moran.
Here.
Regent Page.
Here.
Regent Perkins.
Here.
Regent Trachok.
Here.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dean Gould. If people would join me in the Pledge of Allegiance, please. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. We will go to item one, public comment.
Okay, Mr. Chair, we have several items in public comment, which I'll read. First one is submitted by Kendra Newman, N-E-W-M-A-N. I think it is kind of ridiculous to charge the students extra money per credit due to UNLV losing funding money and due to the pandemic. The school is not the only one suffering financially. Families and students are too. We students have worked our butts off to get scholarships, WUE financial aid, and pull out loans months before school, as all students should plan for the cost of tuition. It is unfair to hit students with extra charges less than a month before school starts. This has, will result in multiple of students dropping out, switching to in-state online classes, or joining the military. This will make UNLV lose even more money, as their student numbers attending this fall will drop significantly. While to you a $100 per semester may not be a lot of money, it is to other families and students who are also suffering financially from the pandemic. Money does not grow on trees, and the pandemic does not just affect the colleges or other programs, but many other families. I think students should always be thought of first, since that is the school's number one source of money. Without students attending UNLV, there will be no UNLV. Many of us choose UNLV because it was one of few colleges opening up in the fall. This has crushed many students' dreams. There is other ways for the college to gain money, whether it's cutting budgets from other financial needs, fundraisers, donations, etc. We students attend college to go into the medical field, become teachers, engineers, psychologists, athletic trainers, etc. Without students attending college, there will be a short in those fields. We are the future, and our opinion should be heard and taken into evaluation. The next one is from Moulin Patel, P-A-T-E-L. Please reconsider the increased charge per credit hour. In times like these, everyone is already struggling, and adding extra fees on top of that is not helping. A college education is very important, but having to pay more will make it harder for students who are struggling to get by to obtain one. The next one is from Sage Ellis, E-L-L-I-S. I'm an alumni of University of Nevada, Reno, and currently still work on campus as a research assistant in the College of Agriculture. I'm emailing to voice my concern about changing the language of Title IX to conform with Betsy DeVos's new ruling on proving sexual assault. This will be harmful to our students and makes it harder to protect and provide healing for students affected by sexual violence. I support ENCHI to join the lawsuit against Betsy DeVos's changes to Title IX to protect our students. The next one is from Lauren Harvey, H-A-R-V-E-Y. As a woman and college student, sexual assault is as common a term in my life as the phrases all-nighter and did you do the homework. Constantly, college women are told to be aware of their surroundings or to not wear this or that in order to appease the malignant rape culture that exists within this country. Every woman, no matter what race, religion, ethnicity, or experiential background they come from, knows someone who has been made victim to sexual violence. I know many. I assure you that the changes proposed in these final Title IX regulations serve only to harm survivors. Irregardless of whatever benefits may be gained from this rule, the harmful and traumatic effects it will have on sexual assault survivors is great. I ask you not only to vote no on becoming compliant with these new regulations, but to actively oppose them by joining the countless other states who have filed lawsuits against this policy. A law without justice has no place in our democracy. Next one is from Gabrielle Staples, S-T-A-P-L-E-S. Good afternoon. Today I am in opposition to changing to the language of Title IX to conform to Betsy DeVos's new ruling. I feel that this ruling dehumanizes the sexual assault experiences of students on campus when, instead of making it harder for students to prove a sexual assault experience, we should be providing safe spaces for students to come forward with their experiences and receive justice. Our students and faculty who work and attend school under ENSHE and who have experienced sexual assault should not live in fear of their attackers feeling like the very campuses we are told are quote unquote safe are not backing up survivors when they come to report a sexual assault case and seek justice in a timely manner. The next one is from Sandra Cosgrove, C-O-S-G-R-O-V-E. My name is Dr. Sandra Cosgrove, and I'm a history professor at the College of Southern Nevada. I would like to ask the regents to not adopt their new regulations for addressing sexual harassment under Title IX. There are four major lawsuits pending on these regulations, so there is at least sufficient probability that the regulations will be altered or enjoined by a court. Furthermore, we should not adopt regulations that will fail to protect individual rights. The new definition of sexual harassment is so narrow that only the most egregious sexual behavior would be prohibited in the ENSHE code, while simultaneously less reprehensible behavior could serve as the foundation for a civil lawsuit or a criminal complaint. Please, if possible, ask for the adoption deadline to be suspended until all litigation is resolved. The next one is from Elliot Bailey, B-A-I-L-E-Y. The new proposed language for Title IX requiring X, Y, and Z instead of X, Y, or Z that have happened to be protected is very harmful and dangerous. Not all acts of sexual violence or gender discrimination look the same. The next one is from Madison Hall, H-A-L-L. Changing the word of Title IX will only make it harder for sexual assault victims to get the justice they deserve. Men, who make up a majority of the Board of Regents, often do not understand the extent of the damage that sexual assault does to victims. This will only make it easier for offenders to keep assaulting multiple victims. Please, please do not change the wording of Title IX if you have the best interest of students in mind. The next one is from Mackenzie Papa, P-A-P-A. As a student of the University of Nevada, Reno, I feel that it is important for the Board of Regents to vote against changing the language under Title IX regulations according to Betsy DeVos's new ruling. The language that this ruling calls for is extremely dangerous to students and makes it all the more difficult for sexual assault victims to seek justice and get help. Please consider the safety and well-being of ENSHE students as you vote. The last one is from Madison Quillicy, Q-U-I-L-L-I-C-Y. There is no acceptable excuse for limiting the support of those affected by sexual harassment because of a lack of funding. There needs to be a high priority for the safety and protection for all students regarding all circumstances. That concludes the public comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gould. We will go to item two, Chancellor's report.
Thank you, Chair DeBrava. I have two items I was going to report to, just an update on the 32nd special legislative session, and then an update on the UNR presidential search. So the Nevada legislature was called into the 32nd special session by the order of Governor Sisolak's proclamation on Friday, July 31st, 2020. This legislature was expected to address gaps and inequities in the following areas: criminal and social justice policy reform, unemployment support and unemployment insurance, voting rights, stabilization of Nevada businesses, judicial branch authority to dispute rental evictions, mining taxes, and other items requested by LCB. There were three items that we monitored that impacted Nevada system of higher education. The first being AB3 that focused on police reform. Both of our police chiefs did an excellent job supporting this bill. Both of them testified, and it was passed and signed by the governor. The bill does the following, among other things: it authorizes persons to record police activity. A police officer may only use reasonable force. It suspends the use of police chokeholds, requires other officers to stop colleagues if unreasonable force is being used, requires law enforcement to stop, requires law enforcement agencies to provide to the 81st legislative data information on traffic stops. SB2 revises provisions relating to peace officers. We did not testify. We were not asked to testify. It did pass, but basically it gave more power to discipline officers, and both our police chiefs, North and South, were fine with the bill that was passed. Our team also monitored Senate Bill 4 that offers protection to certain businesses and local municipalities to ensure safety while Nevada reopens. This measure balances the protection of businesses and workers. The bad actors who ignore protocols will not be protected from liability. The bill does not provide immunity to all businesses, but it does cover governmental entities, which includes the state of Nevada, its agencies and political subdivisions. This legal definition is intentionally broad and covers NCHI along with other executive branch entities. So while NCHI is not specifically named, neither are all those other government entities that are covered. Governor Sisolak's proclamation of the special session specifically directed that NCHI be included in any immunity bill passed by the legislature, and it was expressly confirmed on legislative record during Senate testimony by the bill sponsor that governmental entity included NCHI. So those were the three bills. I wanted to thank both our police chiefs who supported the police reforms bill and who testified, and our government affairs, Michael Flores and his team, who did an excellent job ensuring that we're included in the worker liability to ensure that it was actually put on record. The second item, I just wanted to give a quick update on the UNR presidential search. So on August 13th, we'll convene to select the semifinalists. That'd be myself, along with the chair of the committee, Rick Trachuk, counsel Dean Gould, and our incoming chancellor, Melanie Rose. And so at that meeting, we'll actually be reviewing all the resumes that were submitted and recommended by the search firm, and then we'll identify those individuals that will receive interviews, semifinalist interviews via Skype. Those that are selected will participate in review in those interviews on August 24th and 25th. Those will be conducted by myself and the incoming chancellor, Melanie Rose. And then the week of September 14th is we bring in the candidates, ideally four, we don't know at this point. And that will mirror the process that we set up for UNLV. The 14th and 15th, the Monday and Tuesday, all four of the candidates will come in into a series of public forums. They'll be in person at this point at UNR. Then on the 16th, the advisory committee will meet. We'll have the same setup. The advisory committee will meet virtually, but the candidates will be there in person. And then on Thursday, the 17th at 1, similar to what we did at UNLV, the Board of Regents will actually make the selection of the new president at UNR. And Chair DeBravo, that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor Riley. My report, the board chair's report, for context, I want to mentioned to the board that I plan to bring to our August 21st Board of Regent meeting a proposal for the board to consider the creation of a special committee. This committee would respond to the current budget reduction and future budget reductions of state funding for our Nevada system of higher education. Keeping in line with our previous discussions of maybe not doing across-the-board cuts, but trying to be more strategic, And as we look at possible efficiencies, cost savings, and potential new revenue sources, again, this item will be brought to our August 21st meeting for the board to decide if they want to establish this special committee. So keep that in mind, please. Also, as far as housekeeping, I just wanted to mention on agenda item 8 that was posted and for possible action. And I'll let, as we get to item 8, the Chancellor and CFO Andrew Klinger will talk. We are okay if we decide to discuss some different proposals and to decide to delay any action until our August 21st meeting. So again, there might be some proposals coming forward. I didn't want the board members to feel that we were under some pressure to take action today. We could actually do that on the 21st. And finally, on behalf of the board, I would like to offer our condolences to Regent Trachok on the loss of his father, Dick Trachok. Regent Trachok, for you and your family to suffer the loss, we know how hard it is. And we know that your father was a beloved individual, of course, to the family and to the University of Nevada, Reno, and to the state of Nevada. So we offer our condolences. I'm going to move to item 4, the minutes. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Motion.
Second. I have, and for Dean Gould, I think that was Regent Perkins was the motion.
Yes.
And we had a second from Regent Carter, I believe. And Dean Gould, do you need a roll call vote for the minutes?
I do, because I have no way of knowing who's voting and who isn't, because people are dropping and coming. So if it's okay, I'd just rather we do roll call on all of them.
Any discussion or any edits, corrections, comments about the minutes? Seeing none, go ahead and do the roll call vote, please, Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Aye.
Chair Dubrava.
Yes.
Regent Geddes.
Aye.
Regent Hayes. Regent Levine.
Yes.
Regent McAdoo.
Yes.
Regent McMichael.
Yes.
Regent Moran. Regent Page.
Aye.
Regent Perkins.
Aye.
Regent Trachok.
Aye.
Regent Carter.
Aye.
Regent Carvalho.
Aye.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Dean Gould. We will move to item 5, Handbook Revision, Millennium Scholarship, Spring 2020 Continuing Eligibility Waiver. And we will have Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, Crystal Abba. Crystal, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me? I just want to make sure before I get started. For the record, I'm Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs with the Nevada System of Higher Education. Today, I bring to you a policy proposal that will revise the provisions of Title IV, Chapter 18, Section 9, and will effectively implement a waiver of continuing eligibility requirements for students that lost eligibility in spring 2020 as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, I'm going to cover 4 basic areas. One is, why did we go down this road in seeking the waiver, specifically the request for authority to do so by the legislature. I'll also cover the provisions of Senate Bill 12, how that bill was revised during the session, and how the revisions impact implementation. I will review the policy proposal, specifically page 4, outlining the specific handbook revisions. And finally, the impact to the Millennium Scholarship Trust Fund in terms of the cost of the waiver as this waiver is implemented. But before I begin, I would like to read into the record a letter that we received from the Office of the Treasurer, Zach Conine, dated August 5th, 2020. This letter, obviously I'll read it into the record now, but it'll be included with the minutes. August 5th, 2020, dear Chair DeBrava and Regents, the State Treasurer's Office oversees a number of critical state functions, including administration of the Governor Gwynne Melinda Fellowship Program in coordination with the Nevada System of Higher Education. In light of the recent circumstances surrounding COVID-19, temporary closure of campuses throughout our state, the Treasurer's Office has received a number of emails and calls from concerned NSHE students and families on the impact of the pandemic, that the impact the pandemic will have on their Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship eligibility. To alleviate worries among Nevadans during this uncertain time, I write in support of a blanket waiver process for the spring 2020 semester as approved under agenda item, as proposed under agenda item number 5 of the August 7th, 2020 Board of Regents special meeting. As stewards of this long-standing Nevada scholarship program, we owe our students predictability and a willingness to be flexible in eligibility standards during such an unprecedented time. Our office stands willing and able to partner with the Nevada System of Higher Education on the mechanics of these changes in order to ensure minimal impacts are felt by our students and families. Additionally, our office looks forward to working with NSHE and the governor, the legislature, and other stakeholders on developing and implementing permanent changes to the Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship that will enable it to continue helping students for the next 20 years. Thank you for your consideration during this difficult time of our state and its residents. I appreciate the opportunity to share my support on this agenda item. Sincerely, Zach Conine, Nevada State Treasurer. Just as a personal matter, Mr. Conine and his office, during this process of determining appropriate steps that would be taken in order to implement the waiver, their staff, as well as himself, have been extremely helpful. So I would like to publicly indicate my gratitude to that office for their help. So to begin, why are we going down this road of requesting a waiver? As you know, as a result of the pandemic and the subsequent stay-at-home orders issued by the governor, NSHE and its institution closed their campuses, and students were quickly moved to remote instruction. Due to circumstances beyond their control, many students receiving the Millennium Scholarship who originally enrolled in traditional face-to-face courses were transitioned during the spring 2020 semester. But in addition to that, we know that many of our students faced factors that may have impacted their academic record during the spring 2020, including loss of employment, caring for family members. With respect to continuing eligibility in particular, the GPA requirement is provided for in NRS 396-934 and board policy. That's the section on that we will be revising today in the handbook provision. So it is possible, because that is a semester GPA and not a cumulative GPA, that as a result, it is possible that a high performing student with a high cumulative GPA could have had their semester GPA drop below the requirement for eligibility during the spring 2020 semester. And doing so, they would earn a strike and lose eligibility for the subsequent term. Students that earned a second strike would, of course, lose eligibility permanently under the current constructs of the program. Further, continuing eligibility requires that students complete 9 or 12 credits, depending on the institution that they are attending. Again, the student's ability to complete the courses may have been impacted during the pandemic and as a result of the shift to remote instruction. So our challenge was, during the stay-at-home phase, this office received a number of phone calls and emails from students expressing concern about losing eligibility. And as you heard from the letter from the state treasurer, their office, I actually think in terms of volume, they didn't track those calls, but they received considerably more phone calls and emails from students during that time. And this was all occurring around April and May. The challenge that we had in April and May, and this was a discussion that Chancellor Riley and I had and the cabinet had over a number of weeks, which is we had no way during those months to determine the actual impact, because obviously, one of the most significant factors in determining eligibility was GPA, and grades hadn't been posted. So we had no way at that time to determine the magnitude of the issue. However, by mid-June, and this is getting close to the 31st special session, when the grades were posted, we began to work with the treasurer's office to determine the number of students that had lost eligibility. ultimately, after some back and forth with the treasurer's office, we ended up running a list, conducting a query, and we determined at that time, and this is a little bit of an organic number because obviously as grades are posted, sometimes there are grade appeals or there's errors in grades. But at the time when we ran this towards the end of June, there were 12.9% of eligible students that had been funded in spring of 2020 that lost eligibility. Now, we can't tell, obviously, from that whether or not they lost eligibility as a result of the impact. All we can tell is, did they meet the eligibility criteria that are outlined in the statute and section 9.14 of the board handbook? For comparison, and again, it was about 2,200 students that lost eligibility, which is about 12.9%. Going back a year to spring of 19, for the purpose of comparison, almost 20%, 19.6%, or 3,200 students that had been funded during that term lost eligibility. So given the fact, obviously, what you see is a drop, fewer students lost eligibility. There may be a number of factors related to why that occurred. Obviously, the impact of allowing students to have the option to select SU grades would have had a positive impact on that. But when we saw the new numbers, it begged the question, well, do we really need to go down this road? And at that time, the chancellor and I had a number of conversations again with the cabinet, and we felt that it was the prudent thing to do because we couldn't know from each student individually how they were impacted. We felt that it was the right thing to do to move forward in requesting authorization from the legislature to seek the waiver. At that time, we also had the same conversation with the treasurer's office, and they were supportive of moving forward. And so that, of course, brought us to the 31st special session. The governor issued his proclamation, which allowed to deal with the situation of the budget cuts and specifically the Millennium Scholarship. So with that, I'll now quickly go through the provisions of Senate Bill 2. You'll see in the agenda item language, there is a hyperlink there so that you can access the bill if you would like to look at that. The applicability of Senate Bill 2 is extremely narrow, and this was on purpose. As we worked with the governor's office in crafting that language, we felt that it was appropriate for this to be applicable only during an emergency or a disaster situation, which is specifically noted in the provisions of that bill. There are also clear authorization to implement the waiver of continuing eligibility requirements only. It does not address initial eligibility requirements. We had a number of conversations with the school districts, and based on flexibility that existed in procedures and guidelines, we determined that it wasn't necessary to seek that waiver as well. So during the session, we had a hearing before the Committee of the Whole with the Senate and the Assembly. The Senate did amend the bill, and there were three significant revisions in their amendments. First, they sunsetted the bill. There was a general feeling that while the trigger for the bill was a state of emergency or a declaration of disaster that was issued by the governor, there was concern that there's never a follow-up proclamation that says, okay, the disaster's over, the emergency is over. So they felt that it was appropriate to include a sunset that basically goes through to July 1, 2020. That would essentially provide that if the board wants to issue a waiver for fall 20, so the term coming up, or for spring 21, they would have the opportunity to do so. However, to be clear, today's proposal is only for spring of 2020. In addition, the amendments that were adopted by the Senate included moving up the reporting requirement so that we have to report to the legislature via the Legislative Council Bureau within 45 days of the waiver becoming effective. And in a moment, I'll discuss the specific implementation procedures that we will be following and at what point in time that waiver becomes, for the purpose of the statute, effective. And finally, the Senate put in a provision that requires that a person be designated to present to the legislature or the Legislative Committee on Education should the legislature not be in session. And the purpose of that presentation, of course, would be to personally present to the legislature what students, the number of students, and the procedures that we follow in regards to implementing the waiver. So with that, I would now refer you to the briefing paper and the policy proposal that is hyperlinked to the agenda item. So if you could specifically please refer to page 4, you'll see that there is a new section 9.14.1, and I'll take you through that. There's some resolution type language that basically indicates that we're putting this provision in place under the specific authority of Senate Bill 2 that was adopted during the special session, and that this is a temporary waiver only. And then the board basically, through the adoption of this revision, is directing our office that students that received the Millennium Scholarship in spring of 2020 who lost eligibility at the end of the term pursuant to the prior section, which again denotes the continuing eligibility requirements, shall receive a waiver and be deemed eligible to receive funding in the subsequent term for which they enroll. Further, these students will not receive a strike. So for those of you who may not be very familiar with the program, there's a two-strike rule or a two-strike provision that's in the statute, and it basically provides that a student can lose eligibility, they can regain it, and when they lose eligibility again, that, of course, is the second strike. And again, there were some students who lost eligibility in spring of 2020 who may have received a second strike, and as a result, they would have been permanently ineligible for the program. Referring to subsection B of the new section 9.14.1, the Chancellor's Office will transmit to the Treasurer's Office a list of students deemed eligible pursuant to this section. We will begin that process and transmit that list as early as Monday or Tuesday. They will then update their records, and it's at that point in time that the student and the waiver becomes officially effective. So that's basically when the 45-day clock starts to tick on the reporting requirement. The Chancellor, the final provision there is that the Chancellor or their designee shall report on the waiver to the legislature or the legislative committee should the legislature not be in session. Now, I think the challenge there is typically the Legislative Committee on Education is an interim standing committee. They have concluded their work by September, so they actually may not have another meeting between now and the convening of the 21 legislative session. So I anticipate, based on those scheduling issues, that we will be reporting in the 21 session and probably won't report between now and the convening of the session in February of 21. So that concludes the actual provisions. Again, you'll see from the briefing paper that when we ran an initial list of students that lost eligibility, and we did that, it was July 24th, you'll see noted in the briefing paper that 2,191 students as of August 24th lost eligibility at the end of the spring semester. So that was kind of our preliminary take on this. That number, of course, is very similar to the number that we ran in early June. However, it is slightly lower. And again, some of that is due to grade revisions, grade appeals, and things of that nature. We'll rerun the list, and we will also, in terms of the procedure that we will follow with the Treasurer's Office, we will do a reconciliation with the Treasurer's Office. So they are considered the official student record for the purpose of eligibility. They'll run their list, we're going to give them our list, and we're going to make sure that there are no discrepancies in that. As many of you are aware, the Millennium Scholarship is not available to only public institutions. It is also available, there's a specific provision in statute for post-secondary education institutions that are domiciled in Nevada, and there are basically two of those, Roseman University and Sierra Nevada College. We obviously do not have access to their records. However, the treasurer is now reaching out to those institutions, and they will establish a similar protocol for identifying those students, reconciling, and ensuring that those students as well have their those that lost eligibility received the waiver. And again, to meet the reporting requirements, we will craft a letter within the 45 days to the, and it will come from the chair of the Board of Regents. It will basically indicate the number of students that were determined to be eligible for the waiver. It'll also discuss the process that we went through in terms of reconciliation so that all of that is documented. One thing that it is important to note, and this will go to the cost, a student who was enrolled in spring of 2020 who may have lost eligibility, through this process, they would be deemed eligible. That means basically that when you look at the student record at the state treasurer's office, it would say you're eligible. Now, they may not enroll in fall of 2020. They may decide, you know what, there's too much uncertainty, or for whatever reason, I'm not going to enroll in fall of 2020. I'm going to wait and enroll in the spring, or I'm going to wait and enroll in fall of 21. This waiver will be in place for any subsequent semester in which they enroll within the six-year limitation. So there is a provision in the statute and in the board handbook where students, because this program was designed for students coming out of high school, and they basically have access to that scholarship for the 6 years following high school graduation, although there are some exceptions to that. So that brings me to the final issue, which I know is of concern to many of you, which is what will this cost? You see noted in the fiscal statement on the agenda item, there is no direct cost to ENSHE or its institutions. Of course, however, there is a cost to the Millennium Scholarship Trust Fund, which is administered by the Treasurer's Office. Again, we had numerous conversations with Treasurer Conine, and to correct him, he basically said that the $2.6 million that we calculated, and they agreed with our calculation, and I'll explain in a moment how we came to that number, that it could be absorbed and it wouldn't materially break the trust fund. Although, as many of you know, there have been conversations and there is concern about that fund, because over time there have been infusions into that fund. The predominant source of funding there is the tobacco settlement. However, over time, they have included funding from unclaimed property. Various governors have infused it with an infusion from the general fund in the GovRec that ultimately took place. But we felt at this time, based on those conversations, again, that it would not be a material impact. The $2.6 million estimate is based on basically taking 2,200 students and assuming the max, that they were all enrolled at the maximum reimbursement amount, or the maximum credit amount of $80 per credit, which is at the universities, and they all get funded at 15 credits. Now, obviously, not all of them will be enrolled at the universities, and not all of them will be enrolled at 15 credits. 15 credits is the maximum. In terms of eligibility, the credit load requirement at the community colleges is 9 credits, so some students may be at 9, they may be at 12, they may be at 15. The minimum credit requirement at the universities is 12, so they have to enroll in at least 12 credits in order to be eligible. But again, the funding maximum, they can be funded up to 15 credits. So we based our estimate very simply based on 2,200 times 80 times 15. Yeah, that's the math on that, 2.6 million. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation. I would be happy to answer any questions. And with that, I would also request the board's approval of the proposed revision to Title IV, Chapter 18, Section 9.
Motion for approval.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor Abba. I have a motion from Regent Geddes, and I have a second from Regent McAdoo.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Laura Perkins.
Yes, I have some questions. Ms. Regent Levine is first, and then Carvalho, and then Regent Perkins. I'll put you on the list. So, Regent Levine.
Thank you, Chair. Vice Chancellor Abba, I just want to say thank you so much for doing this. I received the Millennium Scholarship when I was an undergraduate student, and it was incredibly helpful. It was a lifeline, and there was always anxiety about losing it, but I can't even imagine what that anxiety would have been like for students having gone through the pandemic. So I just want to say thank you so much. I want to thank the Chancellor, and I want to thank the Government Relations team. And I just also want to highlight just some of the incredible partnerships that we've heard today so far that ENSHE was able to accomplish. From the Millennium Scholarship Flexibility, the partnerships on policing policies, which thank you, Chancellor and Michael, for your work on that, the teaching grant, and the liability coverage. So it just shows all of the opportunity that is out there for us to be working together with state and government leaders. So Vice Chancellor Abba, truly, thank you again.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Regent Levine. Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Crystal, so as the economic and educational ramifications of COVID-19 continue to unfold, students are facing continued additional external pressures such as unemployment, childcare, availability concerns. And I understand this waiver is for students for spring of 2020. At what point would you or your staff start to consider this for fall of 2020 or even spring of 2021?
That's a good question. And I think we have to see what happens. I mean, we've already had those discussions in our office. I have to tell you that I think that we would take very honestly a conservative approach, because the difference between spring 2020 and fall 2020 is that spring 2020, we started the semester and nobody was wearing a mask and life was normal and you could go to the grocery store and not be afraid. Now, as students enrolled for their courses for fall of 2020, they have full awareness of the fact that if they are taking a traditional face-to-face course, there may be a point in time during the fall semester in which they are required to quickly shift to remote instruction. And all of our institutions are prepared to do so. So I think it becomes more difficult to justify that. However, I think, and my thanks to the legislature on this, obviously they are contemplating that if something again unforeseen happens where it is justifiable, we have the authority to do so.
Thank you. My second question, if you don't mind, Chair, is, so I guess I'm old enough to have not received the Millennium Scholarship. So I don't know exactly how, are students warned sometime during the semester that, hey, if you're falling below a certain GPA, that they realize before the end of the semester that they may lose it or they have a strike against them? I'm asking because I've had some students reach out to me in the past, asking those questions. Or, and also as a second part to that, you mentioned that they will continue with eligibility even if they do decide not to enroll in fall 2020 or spring 2021. So those students also know that when they come back, their eligibility is there for them.
Yeah, and to that point, when their record is changed, they'll receive a formal notification from the treasurer's office. So they'll receive an email that basically says your eligibility status has been updated. In terms of a mid-semester notification, there is no formal process for that. However, I mean, that was basically the legislature's vision with the two-strike rule, so that if a student doesn't realize that there is a GPA requirement, that current 2.75, and they drop below, if they lose it, they get a second opportunity at that. And I will say that within, you know, financial aid for merit-based awards, that's kind of, I mean, it's very generous and it's not the norm. So if they're not aware when they lose it, they will definitely be aware that they can regain it. However, my experience has been that when students receive the scholarship, they receive documentation, they receive a notification that does include what those eligibility requirements are and what the expectation is, because again, it is a merit-based scholarship. Now, whether that actually resonates with them is a different question, but they are provided documentation concerning that.
Thank you.
We will go to Regent Perkins and then Del Carlo. Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to echo some of the words of Regent Levine. Thank you so much, Dr. Abba, or Vice Chancellor Abba, for working with the legislators and working with the treasurer to make sure that our students retain their eligibility under this circumstance. My question is, how many students is this their second strike for that will be able to continue their education?
I don't actually have that data at my fingertips, but that is something that we can pull. So if you'll give me a couple of days, we should be able to determine that, although we'll have to do some back and forth with the treasurer's office. But again, I can get that information and have it transmitted to the question.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say, as a Nevada citizen, I do remember the days when the legislature and our late Governor Quinn put this Millennium Scholarship together. And I think it was probably one of the most positive things we've ever done for the students of Nevada. And the whole purpose of this scholarship, for those of you that may not have lived in Nevada then, was to keep the talent in Nevada. And I don't know if we've accomplished that goal, and maybe at a future meeting, don't want to put any work on anybody, but somewhere down the road, it'd be nice to know the statistics since the millennials started if these students, I don't know if you can able to track them, but is this accomplishing the goal that it set out to do? Because I think this has been a very important scholarship. This one's based on merit. And sometimes we overlook people on merit because we're so very concerned, as we should be, about people that are need-based. But it's very important that we reward people for merit, too. Thank you. Excuse me. And thank you, Vice Chair Abba and Zach Conine, the treasurer, for working so diligently on this. You always do fine work.
Thank you, Vice Chair DiCarlo. Seeing no other discussion, we have a motion and a second. Chief of Staff Gould, if you would like to take a roll call vote, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regent Geddes.
Aye.
Regent Hayes. Regent Levine.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Regent McAdoo.
Yes.
Regent McMichael.
Yes.
Regent Moran. Regent Page.
Aye.
Regent Perkins.
Yes.
Regent Trachuk.
Aye.
Regent Carter.
Yes.
Regent Carvalho. Vice Chair DiCarlo.
Aye.
Chair Dubrava.
Yes.
Motion passes unanimously, one absence.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief of Staff Gould. We will now go to item 6, Handbook and Code Revisions, NCHE Discrimination and Sexual Harassment Policies and Procedures. And this was one of the main items that had us create this special meeting on this date because of some deadlines. I was going to have Regent Carter say a few comments about how this related to the audit committee that he chairs, and then we'll go to Joe Reynolds. So, Regent Carter.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, the Title IX moved over to audit and compliance probably a little bit greater than a year ago, and we were looking at Title IX changes and knew that this was kind of looming in the background. And for whatever reason, our federal government found that COVID was a convenient time to release this to us and gave us the deadline of August 14th to essentially roll this out. So this is going to probably, this is, as it says earlier in the, our attorney will explain this as well, but we're going to try to enact this as an emergency policy so that's in place for August 14th to meet the requirements that essentially carry the impact of, you know, federal law from Department of Education. I appreciate all the comments that I've gotten in the email from people that don't necessarily, you know, appreciate the policy that was coming down from the Department of Education. And our policy, have we created it, may have not looked exactly like that, but I don't necessarily see a path forward without having us actually put good faith into enacting a policy that meets the guidelines being passed down to us. That's all I wanted to say outside of, you know, we did move this from my audit committee to the full board just so that we could get this accomplished in that timeline of having it in place by August 14th. And eventually this will come back through the audit committee for any final changes and final approval before it comes back to the board for the very final approval, but to have it on our books by the 14th. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Regent Carter. And we'll now go to General Counsel Joe Reynolds to introduce this topic and other speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair DiBrava. Joe Reynolds, Chief Legal Counsel, for the record. As Regent Carter just alluded to, you know, as the Chief Legal Counsel for the system, I share many of the concerns that the board heard this morning in public comment prior to the start of this meeting. These rules were published in May of this year. We've had a little over 90 days to review 2,000 approximately pages of documents, incorporate these into our handbook and our code. And this changes in some key respects 45 years of Title IX jurisprudence and comes in the middle of the pandemic, health and fiscal emergency for the state and the nation. With that being said, These are federal laws. These are federal mandates. The consequences of the board not enacting these new regulations would put us out of compliance with Title IX law. It could subject the board to investigation by the Office of Civil Rights, and it could jeopardize our federal funding. And that federal funding is significant. We receive hundreds of millions of dollars in funds from the federal government each year. There are lawsuits that are ongoing right now that have been commenced by various state attorney generals, some higher education systems, even the ACLU are challenging these regulations. I have been in consultation with Attorney General Ford's office as recent as yesterday. We have a fantastic relationship with them and actively having discussions with them about what litigation would look like for the state of Nevada. But with that being said, we're aware of no court order that has stayed implementation of these rules or any injunction that's been granted. And so our recommendation is that the board needs to adopt these rules, and certainly could have a future conversation about whether the board was interested in entertaining any litigation. We have Deputy Counsel Zalalem Bogali, and also UNR's Title IX Director, Maria Ducepre, who have spearheaded the effort to implement and draft amendments to conform to these two Title IX regulations. And I'll turn that over to them, but I would just acknowledge a lot of weekends and late nights went into this work, and they did a real Herculean effort. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chief Counsel Joe Reynolds. Can everybody hear me? Yes, thumbs up. Okay. Thank you and good morning, Chair Dubrava. Good morning, members of the Board of Regents. Good morning to institution presidents, faculty and student leaders, and anybody else who may be watching or listening right now. For the record, I am Zalalem Bogali, Deputy General Counsel for System Administration at the Nevada System of Higher Education. And I'm here this morning virtually with Maria Ducepre, Title IX and ADA Coordinator at the University of Nevada, Reno, to present on this agenda item for possible action, okay, which involves proposed revisions to the handbook and the code pertaining to the board's policy against discrimination and harassment, particularly sexual harassment under Title IX. As you can see there from the reference material and supplemental material, the proposed revisions are extensive and cover Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 13 of the handbook, which is NC's anti-discrimination policy, Chapter 10 of the code, which pertains to the student code of conduct, and Section 5.6.2 of the code, provisions pertaining to confidentiality of certain personnel records. So before I begin, I just wanted to touch upon three things. First is a housekeeping matter. The reference material linked on the agenda contains all the revisions we are proposing, okay? And it's 95 pages in length. Separately, you received supplemental material, I believe, yesterday. That is 32 pages in length. The supplemental material replaces pages 63 through 94 of the reference material linked on the agenda, okay? And pertains only to the Chapter 10 proposed revisions. So please, if you don't mind, refer to the supplemental material there to review the revisions to Chapter 10, or if you intend to make a motion with respect to Chapter 10. Second, as Joe just mentioned, the assistance and cooperation of the members of the Title IX work group was a working group of lawyers and Title IX personnel across NC that helped craft these revisions, should be acknowledged. So I'd like to do so now. Maria Ducepre, Title IX and ADA coordinator at UNR, Michelle Sposito, the Title IX coordinator at UNLV, Mark Gann, Vice President of Special Projects and General Counsel at Western Nevada College, Mary Dugan, General Counsel at UNR, Deborah Peruchka, Assistant General Counsel at UNLV, and Melissa Barnard, Assistant General Counsel at UNR. In addition, I'd like to thank Chief General Counsel Joe Reynolds for convening this work group, and John Albrecht as well, the General Counsel for TMCC, DRI, and GBC, for his consultation and input. Third and finally, before I get to the presentation, we were careful to keep faculty leaders, student leaders, and Title IX coordinators apprised of our work throughout this process. And each of those groups had an opportunity to review these revisions before we submitted them to the board for consideration. So I just wanted to put that on the record. So a brief roadmap of our presentation here, which we'll seek to keep fairly general and high level here because, 95 pages of revisions, we could talk about every single page if you want, but it would take much longer than 60 minutes. So three overall parts: the background, substance, and questions. And of course, you're free to interrupt and ask questions at any time. So the background. Why are we here? Well, as the briefing paper indicates, on May 6th, which I remind you was only 3 months ago, the Department of Education promulgated new regulations that control how colleges and universities, as well as K through 12 schools, must respond to reports of sexual harassment, including sexual assault, under Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, which states, quote, "No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance." These new regulations are the result of the formal and lengthy notice and comment rulemaking process that administrative agencies at the federal level may employ to promulgate federal regulations. And as a consequence, and this is important, the new rule is not merely guidance, right, but consists of legally binding federal regulations that carry the force and effect of law. Regulations are extremely lengthy, totaling over 2,000 pages. The rule itself is actually only 25 pages, but the rest consists of legal analysis and discussion from the Department of Education to help explain the provisions of the rule itself. The work group engaged in a massive effort to review, digest, and analyze all 2,033 pages, meeting twice a week for 2 hours or more each meeting for over 2 months to present these revisions to you today. And I just can't thank them enough for all their hard work and valuable time. The reason we are here today is because the effective date of these new legally binding federal regulations is August 14th, 2020, which is a week from today. And if our policy does not conform by then, we will be in violation of federal law, which, as Joe has just mentioned, could pose a risk of jeopardizing our federal funding. In fact, institutions across the country have already started changing their policies to conform with these new regulations. Just in the past few weeks, Stanford University, the University of Wisconsin, the University of Oklahoma, the University of Alaska, Dartmouth College, Princeton University, the University of Missouri, Georgetown University, Duke University, the University of Minnesota, the University of Colorado, and the University of Arizona have passed conforming policies, begun the implementation of these new regulations ahead of the August 14th date. And in the coming week, I'm sure, we will see more colleges and universities doing the same. Moving on sort of to the second part of this, the substance of these revisions, which for your edification, we have broken down into five general sections. Okay. The first, the new definition of sexual harassment. The second, the investigation. Third, the live hearing requirement. Fourth, the informal resolution option. And five, revisions to our policy that govern conduct outside of the Title IX context. Okay, and that's the part Maria will be talking about. So starting with the new definition of sexual harassment. Previously, one of the categories of conduct that was prohibited under Title IX was conduct on the basis of sex that is severe, pervasive, or objectively offensive, right? The new rule makes simple yet significant to that phrase. And you can find this there on pages 44 and 45 of 95 of the reference material. Now prohibits conduct on the basis of sex that is severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive. Change the or to an and. This means a complainant or an alleged victim of sexual harassment must satisfy all three of those elements rather than only one. Right? So a complainant must show that the conduct was severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive. So this narrows, naturally, the scope of conduct captured under Title IX. It's important to point out that the new rule maintains the two other categories of sexual harassment, including so-called quid pro quo harassment and sexual assault as defined by the Clery Act, including but not limited to rape, dating violence, domestic violence, and stalking. In addition, jurisdictionally, the new rule further defines the meaning of the phrase education program or activity in a few important ways, which I'd like to point out. It includes physical locations and events over which the institution exercises, quote, substantial control over both the respondent and the context in which the sexual harassment occurs. Okay, so this essentially expands the jurisdiction. It could occur at a social event outside of campus that is sponsored by the university, as long as they're exercising substantial control over both the respondent there and the context in which it occurs. Okay. It also explicitly includes any building owned or controlled by a student organization that is officially recognized by the college or university. And importantly, it explicitly excludes conduct outside of the United States. For example, sexual assault during a study abroad program is not covered. So those, I thought, were the top line highlights of the new definition of sexual harassment. Moving on to the second part of this, the investigation. And I'm sorry, I'm hearing a little bit of feedback. Is that just me?
No, I'm hearing it too. If everyone can make sure they're muted, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Hey, Dean, I appreciate it. Thank you. So moving on to investigations, which begins on page 54 of 95 of the reference material. So a few points I'd like to point out here. Institutions must investigate all allegations in a formal complaint, right? And that is how a complainant must make the allegations in the first place, is through a formal complaint. Institutions must dismiss a formal complaint as well, must dismiss it if it determines the conduct does not constitute sexual harassment as explained above, or if, for example, the activity took place outside of the United States. That's new, right? So the rule says you got to dismiss it if jurisdictionally it doesn't fit, or the institution determines that under the new definition of sexual harassment, the conduct doesn't fit. The investigations section also includes a presumption that the respondent, the alleged perpetrator, is not responsible for the alleged conduct until a determination is made at the conclusion of the process. This, for all of you that follow, you know, court shows, this is just like the presumption of innocence in criminal law, right? The respondent is presumed innocent until found otherwise at a hearing. And finally, during the investigation, the institution must provide parties an equal opportunity to inspect and review any evidence that is provided during the investigation that relates directly to the allegations raised in the formal complaint. So this is sort of a fairness principle, providing equal access to all of the information that the investigator finds out during the investigation. Next section here is the live hearing requirement. This is, you know, this was the main sort of component of this new rule that caught a lot of people's attention from the moment it was announced. And, you know, the Department of Education began this formal rulemaking process late 2018. And so, you know, for over a year and a half now, folks have been talking about this. And I think this is, you know, probably the most significant part, new regulations. Every formal complaint is required to have a live hearing. This is completely new, has never been mandated previously. And as a former prosecutor, I can tell you this live hearing, in my view, appears to resemble a trial proceeding. It's presided over by a hearing officer or a hearing officer, excuse me, who acts kind of like a judge. The department's analysis of this section uses both the singular and the plural, actually, to describe this position, right? Hearing officer or hearing officers. And Maria pointed this out to me. So theoretically, this position could actually be a panel too, like a jury. During the live hearing, there must be cross-examination of the parties and witnesses. Yeah, and cross-examination is a particular legal term, right? It's a term with a specific meaning and function. It's been described by the Supreme Court in the criminal context as, you know, the crucible in which reliability of allegations should be assessed. During the live hearing, cross-examination must be conducted directly and orally and in real time by the party's advisor of choice and never by the party personally. And this is important. If a party does not have an advisor, the rule requires institutions to appoint an advisor free of charge to ask cross-examination questions and follow-up questions at the live hearing. So the rule stated that this advisor may or may not be an attorney. We, in our revisions proposed to you, proposed it not be an attorney for a couple reasons. One, attorneys cost more. And two, we didn't want parties to believe that if they're appointed an attorney, that the advisor is going to behave like one. Because then therefore they would get a higher sort of level of representation. And then if they didn't get that, they could sue the school because they had an expectation that wasn't fulfilled. The analysis of this rule says the advisor at this live hearing is not supposed to act like an advocate, right? Is not supposed to behave like a lawyer, and is only there to relay cross-examination questions on behalf of the party and to ask follow-up questions, right? Nobody knows how this actually will play out in practice, but we decided, we thought it was prudent to ensure that the advisors that are appointed by institutions free of charge are not attorneys. Next is the informal resolution component, which begins on page 59 of 95 of the reference material. I like to describe this as an off-ramp to avoid formal investigation and a live hearing. This is new. So if parties voluntarily consent, they may engage in mediation or alternative dispute resolution in lieu of a formal investigation and a live hearing. So this allows them to sort of take themselves out of the formal process and engage in an informal mediation process to resolve the dispute. This avoids a lengthy investigation, potentially. It also avoids what some may experience as the anxiety of having to attend a live hearing and be subject to cross-examination. And so that was the point of it, and we have included that in the revisions provided to you. There are many other provisions, for example, appeal procedures and training requirements, but I just wanted to touch upon the major provisions here. And before I turn it over to Maria to discuss the non-Title IX revisions in Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 13, I just want to point out that 99% of the revisions we made pursuant to the new regulations were taken verbatim from the rule itself. And we inserted them in identical fashion in Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 13, Sub D, and Chapter 10, which you have as supplemental material. So with that, I'll turn it over to Maria. You're a little bit low.
Okay, let's see. We can adjust here. Is that better?
Yes, it is.
Awesome. Aloha, Chair DeBrava, members of the Board of Regents. For the record, I'm Maria DeSepari. I'm the Title IX coordinator at the University of Nevada, Reno. Mr. Bagala has given us a background as to why we're here. I'd like to focus us a little bit more on how we navigate from this point. The answer to that is found in Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 13 of the Handbook, because therein lies our policy. One policy, but two processes. You've just heard the requirements under the new regulations, or our subsection D of the handbook. But what we haven't told you is what happens with every other incident of unlawful discrimination or harassment that would not be governed under Title IX or the new subsection D. Today in the public comments, we heard students plead with you for help because the new rule is so narrow. They ask you consider the safety of our students. All students, all circumstances. The best way to do this is through the documents sitting before you, Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 13. That one policy with two processes. The final rule describes mandatory elements of a grievance process that each institution must follow for Title IX cases. That is, those cases, those incidents that met that specific definition and those specific jurisdictional requirements that Mr. Bagali just described for you. Other unlawful misconduct and harassment, to include racial, religious, or disability discrimination, race-based harassment, and even Title VII sexual harassment, because Title VII is of the Civil Rights Act, what happens with those? Those would be processed by the institutions in a manner very similar to current practices. Moreover, the institutions would follow what is often referred to as the civil rights model of adjudication. While this portion of the policy, and if you're following along, that's sections A through C, has been updated for clarity, we've included some timelines to be consistent with NERC and EEOC policies. We've removed gender-specific languages, updated the definitions of sexual assault and other sexual misconduct so that it's consistent with the subsection D Title IX definitions. But other than that, much of the procedural requirements and implications remain largely the same for us. What this means is that on our campuses, we will continue to offer resources and assistance to all parties involved in an incident, regardless of whether they are the complainant or the respondent. On our campuses, all the individuals involved would be given the opportunity to have an independent advisor accompany them to meetings. And while they won't be a live cross-examination process, as was described in the Title IX section, all the parties would be given the opportunity to list witnesses and to provide evidence and personally participate in the investigation. In short, the final regs give us a floor, that minimum requirement for what we must. We believe that our students and our faculty, our staff, and our campus communities deserve more. We may
welcome to Blue Jeans.
This works in conjunction with Chapter 6 and 10 of the NC Code and the Nevada Administrative Code to afford a mechanism for disciplining those responsible for unlawful discrimination, while also establishing an infrastructure for ensuring that our campus communities are trained, informed, and safe. The policy requires annual training of not just those who work in Title IX offices and those involved in the Title IX processes, but incorporates the training requirements of VAWA, which is the Violence Against Women Act, of CLERI and the Campus Save Act, or the Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act, and it takes that a step further with the NCGO inclusivity in mind. We broaden those training requirements beyond training on just preventing sexual harassment and violence, but also including training on the prevention of discrimination itself. In summary, the Department of Education has made it clear that in certain cases involving certain individuals, we must take certain actions. But they did nothing to limit our ability, and I would offer our duty, to do something in the many other cases and circumstances that impact our campus communities. This is what our policy does. It implements the federal law as required, but it also affords us a way to govern, assist, and to address the needs of the many individuals who may suffer harm that doesn't meet the definitional or jurisdictional minimums required to trigger the many procedural guarantees of the new regulations. In short, by approving the changes proposed for Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 13 of the handbook, we're providing our campus communities with one policy with a dual applicability that implements the new requirements in a way that best preserves our goals of fairness and thoroughness and sensitivity to the needs of those impacted by allegations of sexual harassment, while at the same time providing processes that affords relief to all individuals impacted by unlawful discrimination. and the training, the education, and prevention that's needed to demonstrate our steadfast commitment to providing campus communities that are safe, diverse, and inclusive throughout Nevada. In short, we need one policy with two processes so that as our students pleaded with you in the beginning, they have the help that they need when they need it. So we ask, you know, for you to consider what we propose. Of course, we're happy to answer any questions you may have. And that's all that we have.
Thank you both for the presentation. And I think the board, we certainly understand the serious nature of this policy and the handbook and code revisions. I do have a motion to approve from Regent Carter with a second from Regent Geddes. And now I want to go to, I have on the list Regent Levine, Carvalho, Perkins, and then we have UNR ASUN President Dominique Hall. So if I could go to Regent Levine first.
Thank you, Chair. Sexual violence on college campuses is a problem across the country, and in Nevada, that is no different. In fact, we're currently ranked as the state with the second highest rate of women murdered by men. And in past years, we've unfortunately been number one. This is a topic I'm deeply connected to. It's very personal for me, and unfortunately, many of those tuned in today know about this all too well. Better grasp why, here's some data. 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men are sexually assaulted while in college. Close to 1 in 10 rapes occur while the victim is at work. And more than 90% of sexual assault victims on college campuses do not report their assault. We should be working to build protections for those whom we serve while breaking down barriers put in place for victims to seek justice. But by adopting these policy changes, Regents are welcoming inappropriate behaviors to be swept under the rug. Regents will be opening the door for victims of sexual violence to be further victimized. And I have to ask, did the Me Too movement teach nothing? And she is asking to be sued over this. These policy changes were released back in May by the Department of Education, 3 months ago. So why in the world is the board seeing this for the first time 1 week prior to it needing to be implemented is beyond me. 3 months was plenty of time for general counsel to come forward to the board and seek input on whether to join litigation. 3 months was plenty of time to gauge the state's attorney general's office, too, instead of them finding out the last hour yesterday as a failure of ENCHI going to them. I've spoken to several students, faculty, and community leaders who, of course, knew that these new DO regs were coming, but did not know, were never reached out to, nor consulted with, so they could give input on ENCHI's plan. Frankly, I will not allow my hand to be forced on voting for a policy that will make it easier for someone on a public college or university campus in the state of Nevada to be sexually assaulted or harassed. And that is entirely what this policy, if implemented, will do. Our option is not just to close our eyes, hold our nose, and pass this, but to hold off, consider signing on to litigation, and seek a temporary injunction and leave it to the courts. That is what should be presented today, Joe, instead. This is wrong, and this is riddled with problems. It turns the process, as you just heard from Z, for a victim seeking justice to instead go through a criminal trial, which, by the way, will cost more money for institutions to spend too. And it will, without a doubt, discourage victims of sexual violence from coming forward. Bad laws are meant to be broken. As policymakers, we have the power to halt this terrible and harmful law. I caution those who vote yes on this, as you will be standing on the side of rapists, violent criminals, and assaulters. I'm voting on behalf of survivors and all victims of sexual violence today. I'm a strong no. I do have a few questions for you, Joe, but at this point, I'll let others speak. And Chair, if you can come back to me, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Levine. Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, following up on Regent Levine's question regarding an injunction, is that possible at this point?
You know, if I could, I was going to go, Joe, to Chancellor Riley, and then if he addresses it, Joe, if you could weigh in after that.
Thank you, Chair DeBrava. Yeah, I was going to mention a couple things. One is we have to keep in mind that these are policies that were implemented by the federal government, not by the board. And unfortunately, that not following through jeopardizes our federal funding. We can take an action back to the board on the 21st to see if the board is interested in joining in litigation. And Joe Reynolds can have continued conversations with the Attorney General's office. But Joe and the Attorney General's office this time don't know of any institution that is not, they're doing this simultaneously. They're not choosing to not do it because of the concern about the federal funds. And that's the predicament that we're involved in. So if the board desires, we could take an action. The board can actually approve us joining in litigation at the next meeting. But again, you know, I checked with Chief Counsel Reynolds in his consultation with the Attorney General's office. We don't know of any institution that is not enacting these in hope that an injunction would stop it. They're simultaneously joining in the lawsuit. So Chief Counsel Reynolds might want to elaborate on that.
Sure. Thank you, Chancellor Riley. And as the board will recall, notification was sent to the entire board on May 7th about the promulgation of these new regulations. And with respect to an injunction, as Chancellor Riley indicated, we're not aware of any federal court that has issued an injunction or a stay to stop the implementation of these rules. And again, the concern is if they were not enacted by the board, as the chancellor stated, that it would jeopardize our federal funding. And again, would like to emphasize that these are not policies that were drafted by this board or from legal. As Zalalem stated, 99% of the language has been incorporated into these new rules. And would also add, so that the board, having myself worked for three attorney generals of the state and also been a criminal prosecutor of sexual assaults, both adults and children, you know, the concerns raised are something that are very dear and important to me. We do have partners at Attorney General Ford's office. And again, we have been in conversation with them about any direction or interest in the board moving forward in joining any litigation. If we were to join litigation, it would be different than say an amicus curiae brief that we sign on. Before the board joins any litigation, it would be as a party, which would require a board vote and board action at a future meeting.
Thank you. And I would imagine that the Attorney General's office has been made well aware of what's going on. I'm sure he speaks with other states' attorney generals, and I know that this has been a conversation among many of them. I have a few other questions. A technical question. I read through the 95 pages. Can you explain why there's a difference in reporting time periods? For example, for employees, a complaint must be brought within 300 days, whereas for students and others, a complaint must be brought by within 180 days. Why is there a difference there? The rest of my questions are on another subject. So if you could just answer that question first, I would appreciate it if the chair is okay with that.
I'm happy.
Yeah, I'm fine. Anybody? Go ahead, Maria. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, the standard duration is 180 days for a civil rights complaint. That said, because of the state laws under the state. The state laws grants under NERC and EEOC grants 300 days for employees. And so what we did was just align the employee rules to match those, as that's what would be applied by the state of Nevada.
Okay, thank you for that clarification on that. Also, I've received numerous emails in opposition to this language change, to this Title IX change. I realize we must comply with federal funding. I want to ask specifically, is this regarding Pell Grants, or is there other federal funding at stake here? Also, I would suggest that our Title IX officers at each institution maybe hold a virtual town hall for students and employees separately to discuss these changes and answer questions regarding the new language, especially since I think that there's a lot of concern that we are solely going with the language of the new Title IX. But like you said, Ms. Doucet-Perry, we have policy and code that goes beyond that. So I think that's an important distinction, and I think we need to really make sure that our students and our employees know that the protections are there for them. It isn't just that we're strictly following Title IX only. So I would suggest that. I think that's it. So, the last thing is that Regent Levine shared with us an article from Inside Higher Ed. It was from 2016, and it stated that 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted in college. While this information is possibly outdated, I was hoping that maybe you, Mr. Bogala, or perhaps Director Garcia could give the board at some other point more current data regarding the number of sexual assaults that happen in our institutions, while keeping in mind that this information is probably not the whole picture, since, as Regent Levine said, most sexual assaults go unreported. I would also think it would be a good thing to follow reports of sexual assault going forward to see if there is a decline in that. I think that that's important to note in terms of reporting and how Title IX has affected this. So, just to go back, I'd like to hear how this affects our federal funding. I hear federal funding, but I'd like to get a little bit more specific on that. Thank you.
Regent Carvalho, I might ask CFO Klinger if he wants to address that with federal funding, just as an overview, or Joe Reynolds, either one to take that.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is Andrew Klinger for the record. And just looking back at fiscal year 2019, and we have to file every year, or what's included in our financial statement is a single audit. And so within the single audit, there is approximately $567 million in federal funds that were expended in fiscal year 2019. And of those, approximately $420 million of those came through the Department of Education. So I don't know if that answers your question specifically.
Can you repeat one more time how much came from the Department of Education?
$420 million came from the Department of Education.
And that would specifically be in danger if we do not approve this language change. Is that correct?
I would defer to General Counsel Reynolds on that question.
Joe Reynolds, for the record. Yes, it's in jeopardy. And while it's difficult to say specifics, the United States Department of Education has that authority to withhold that. And so it's that threat and that consequence is out there.
And that would also mean students would not be able to use their Pell Grants at our institutions. Is that true also?
It's possible. And in a little bit to add, we're in a little bit new frontier in these changes and this type of dynamic and the timing.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Regent Carvalho. Here's who I have on my list. I'm going to go to Regent Perkins. Then I'm going to go to student body presidents Dominique Hall and Joshua Padilla. And then we can return to Regent Levine for questions. So let's go to Regent Perkins, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's so hard to follow the other previous regents because they asked all the questions that I was thinking in the back of my head. Thank you for clarification, and thank you for getting this out so very quickly.
I remember last year this time we got the notice that the rules and regulations were going to change, and then, you know, it took a year, and then they just dropped hot during COVID. So thank you again for all the hard work that you put in to bring this forward to us. Even though I do not agree with the changes, I believe that we should go. I definitely would concur on going forward with the being involved in the lawsuit or some type of injunction to perhaps change these regs later on down the line. On the other hand, this is not like a condoning this bad behavior at all, because sexual assault is very personal to me also. So it's such a hard decision process to give up our funding or to vote on the side of sexual assault. So once again, I just believe that the other questions were answered about the how many reports there are on campus, how many events are we responsible for, the federal funds that will be lost. And when you weigh all those in the crucible, I guess it comes down to yay or nay. But I really would like to see us be involved in the litigation process. So if that comes up at a later meeting, I would be I would definitely be on board for that one. So thank you for all your hard work, and thank you for answering all the questions.
Thank you, Regent Perkins. We will go to ASUN President Dominique Hall.
Hello, everyone. So I do have some personal testimony, but I just wanted to respond to Regent Carvello, just because I personally felt like Regent Levine's data was a little undermined and invalidated by your comments. So through my pertinent data and extensive research on sexual violence, 89% of United States colleges don't report sexual assault. Only two NC schools reported sexual violence, which was UNR and UNLV. And in 2018, from the last annual security report, there were only 14 cases of sexual violence reported on UNR's campus. However, in the 2019 Campus Climate Survey, 12% of the approximate 3,000 students who reported, who participated in the survey, reported that they were a victim of campus sexual violence. So I just hope that data can give you a little bit more. But now I'm going to get into my personal testimony and speak on behalf of students. So if you don't know, my name is Dominique Hall, and I'm the ASUN president. I wanted to just give some personal testimony in opposition to this agenda item and to better provide a better understanding of how this will negatively impact students. Conforming to these new Title IX regulations is very harmful and dangerous for NC students. Through my research as a Nevada fellow for the Every Voice Coalition, I have found data that once again supports Regent Levine's data that shows campus sexual violence is a public health crisis. According to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, also known as RAIN, 23% of women and 5% of men who are students in America will experience sexual violence during their time on campus. The trauma of sexual violence lingers for a lifetime. A single event of this violence will affect a victim for the rest of their lives. Being a student in college is difficult within itself. A vote yes on these regulations will only make it worse for students who are victims of sexual violence. I can speak on this issue firsthand as a sexual assault survivor. An event that happened years ago wasn't processed until my senior year of college. Years worth of trauma almost made me drop out of college during my sophomore year. The last thing a sexual violence victim needs, whether they are a student, a faculty member, or a member of the administration, is more regulations against them and no additional protections for them. There is only one NC policy to prevent sexual violence, and that is mandatory training for employees. Students have been hurt from the neglect of the Nevada legislature. It's time for the Nevada system of higher education to support students and rally for them. As a student body president who is also a sexual assault survivor, I'm sharing my story for the first time, speaking up for students who can't tell their stories. Although there is a deadline in a week, there are 14 other states who were granted temporary injunction by filing a lawsuit. You all have the money and resources to represent yourselves in these lawsuits. Students don't. I encourage our Board of Regents to vote no on these regulations for students and join the other 14 states in the lawsuit against these regulations. And just to be honest, I think these are disgusting policies. And like Regent Levine stated, A vote yes on this means you are siding with the oppressor. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Dominique Hall. I was going to allow Regent Carvalho a quick response, and then we'll go to President Padilla. Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say that I in no way tried to undermine Regent Levine's information regarding sexual assault on campus. I stand with Ms. Hall in saying that it's very important for the Board of Regents and every institution to stand against this. So I want to make that clear. I stated that I realize that the information that comes out in terms of reporting does not show the whole picture. I realize that. And like was said before, 90% of sexual assaults go unreported. And I'm concerned about that. And I want to make sure that our institutions and our board stand with victims at every single hearing or every single time a victim comes forward. I'm not trying to undermine that at all.
Thank you, Regent Carvalho. We will go to CSUN President Joshua Padilla.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had three clarifying questions to double check. One being, so as far as ENCHI's involved, the plan is to pass this today as a just in case to remain in compliance with the Department of Education. And then at the meeting on August 24th, potentially vote to join the ongoing litigation over the very disturbing edits. Two being, is this option to join the ongoing litigation going to be by default? Is going to be on the August 24th meeting by default? And then three, how many regents would be required to vote in favor of the litigation at the August 24th meeting in order to pursue this course of action?
You know, regarding the question of possibly joining with the lawsuit, that could be placed on the August 21st meeting. And in order to give, to go through with that, it would require seven regents voting to make that the will of the board to direct the legal counsel to join or to participate with the attorney general and possible lawsuit. I think, and remind me the second part of your question.
You answered the second part of the question. The second part of the question was about if it was going to be by default, but you just answered it in what you said. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. We have Regent Levine, Regent McMichael, and Regent Del Carlo. Regent Levine.
Chair, I can go last, because I have some questions just about the process, so I'll let other regents speak, because I spoke earlier.
Thank you, Regent Levine. Regent McMichael.
Yes, my question is in regards to the fact that we're looking at this as though fiscally the money that the government could withhold if we do not comply with this directive. Would that be monies that are already in the system? Is there a clawback provision that they could come back and request that this money be already that's in the state coffers go back? Or is it coming up to the fiscal year for allocation of funds? Because we are in a presidential campaign, and by the time really most of this would be implemented fully, we could be in a different administration. So I would just like to check on whether or not there is a clawback clause that would allow monies to be recovered if we were to say no to this provision. Thank you.
CFO Klinger, maybe you could answer that.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Andrew Klinger, I would actually defer to Joe on that provision, if you don't mind.
Sure. General Counsel Reynolds.
Joe Reynolds, for the record. The answer, Regent McMichael, is I don't know. I would imagine it would be prospective as opposed to retroactive. And there is the broad authority by the federal government to ensure our compliance in all higher education institution compliance with Title IX. This is something to comply with Title IX is that we have directors and coordinators at our institutions. It's something that we go to great lengths to ensure that we are in compliance with all the federal titles that govern higher education. And so the kind of the hammer that the federal government holds over us is the threat of if we do not enact these, there's an open question about what will happen with our federal funding, but they do have that authority.
Regent McMichael, did you have any other?
Yes. And following up with that, I believe that in this circumstance, we should not play that much emphasis on funds that might be kept from us. And we should go for the fact that this is a crisis that all institutions should take into consideration, and they should all together fight back the federal government on implementing something as fundamentally changing as this that DeVos is proposing. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Regent Del Carlo, Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair DeRaba. I'm a little bit confused. I heard President Hall say that there's 14 schools that have signed on to the lawsuit and have gotten an injunction, but I thought that's what she said. Then I heard the lawyers, Reynolds and Bagala, say that they're not aware of any injunction. So could I please have some clarification on that?
Sure. This is Joe Reynolds for the record. There are state's attorney generals as well as some institutions. There's actually four separate lawsuits that we're aware of that are ongoing from different groups, government entities, and state's attorney generals involving this. The latest information that I have is while there have been requests in motions to grant injunctions or stays, and while they've been briefed and hearings have been held, none have been granted that we are aware of.
Thank you.
I was Regent Levine. Are you there?
I'm here. Sorry, Chair. Please. You're asking for it. Sorry.
That's all right. We'll go to you, Regent Levine, and then we'll have Regent Carter after you. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Joe, I want to better understand something, and then I'm going to ask a few other questions. If we pass this, if the Board of Regents pass this, something that hasn't been explained yet, we keep saying if we don't pass it, we're going to lose federal funding. If we pass this today, are we hindering the Attorney General's office to sign on to litigation due to a lack of standing?
No. Joe Reynolds to Regent Levine. I do not believe that we would be. That we would still, that I'm aware of no institutions or states that are not complying with this, even the ones that have active litigation pending. And so if it's the direction of the board, that is certainly that something that we would jump on and look at. But while we could contest the law and challenge the law, we could still be in compliance with it, and so could still fight the fight because we disagree with it, but are still enacting it until we get other direction from the courts.
Okay, so now let me ask you this. Am I unmuted? Yeah. Earlier we heard a list of schools that adopted the measure due to the deadline coming up in a week. What schools have signed on to litigation listed out?
I don't know all of them off the top of my head, but I will absolutely can provide those for you. I know that Pennsylvania, Oregon, New York, I believe New Jersey, or at least states that have signed onto that, but I can absolutely get you that information.
Okay. I'm not trying to throw a lot of shade at you today, Joe, but I think we should have had that since we got a list earlier to try to guide us in understanding what schools adopted it. So that certainly shed some light, I think, on the bias here. And then another question to that, what organizations have signed on? I know the ACLU has.
The ACLU is the Joe Reynolds to Regent Levine. ACLU is the most prominent one that I'm aware of. Some women's rights groups have also signed on, and I don't know the names of those off the top of my head.
Okay, now let me ask you this. I wasn't on the board May 7th, so you had mentioned that that was when the first notification came to Regents. When did those states and those colleges sign on to the litigation? When did they start to do that?
I don't have the answer. I mean, I believe that the litigation was filed, at least some of them, in June.
In June. So we've had some time knowing that other states were looking at litigation. Is that right? Since June was over a month ago?
I guess in time with respect to what I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Okay, let me ask you one more question then. When did the Attorney General's office first reach out to you after these Department of Education regs came out?
This was a conversation. You know, we frequently talk with the Attorney General's office. We had conversations in May, June, what they were doing. The Attorney General's office has the independent authority to sign on and do these challenges. And so something that we were communicating back and forth is whether the Nevada Attorney General's office was going to pursue this on their own, irrespective of what the Board of Regents would do or not do.
Joe, those initial communications, was it you reaching out to them or them reaching out to you?
I believe it was them reaching out to us. But also, we talk, I have a lot of friends in the Attorney General's office, as well as Deputy Bogali. We do our best to communicate with them on a host of matters, whether it's a DACA, this. And so there's fluid communication where we can on any of these issues.
And that is my point, is y'all do such a good job. When the ICE ruling came out and students who weren't citizens were going to have to be sent to their homeland countries because of online classes, potentially because of the pandemic, and she was right there to fight on behalf of students without a doubt. There wasn't even hesitation. And that's where, honestly, this becomes very personal and emotional, because I don't understand why a week before this is going to have to be implemented, this is when it's going to be presented to the entirety of the board. 3 months is not a long time to review 2,000 pages. I'm not saying it is. It's wrong. Obviously, the Department of Education did this intentionally in the middle of summer, in the middle of a financial crisis, in the middle of a pandemic. That's not surprising to anyone who works in higher education. And I know that's not surprising to you from Betsy DeVos's administration. But my point is that we had 3 months to say these policies are terrible. They're bad for students. We need to protect students. Of all times, we need to be standing up for students and trying to put any anxiety up far away, because they already have so much to deal with right now. And we should have joined litigation. We should have actively been on the defense. And that is why I'm very disappointed today, because I don't think that has at all been the mentality of general counsel. It's been more, well, we have to do it because we're going to lose federal funding. We didn't have to be put in this position today. We could have been on litigation in June. And so, again, I'm voting no, and that's where I'm at. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Levine. I have Regent Carter, then Regent McAdoo.
Yes, I think Lisa brings up some great points, and I think our Attorney General probably should have done some of that stuff she's been talking about, as this does represent higher education and K through 12. And I'm not sure exactly, you know, why maybe he hasn't done anything towards that. However, as our function, we have to obey the law, and this functions as law. And so to meet compliance, we have to do something today. We can't be non-compliant. So I think, you know, part of this, it was going to come through my committee, and we've been kind of working on this. This has been on the radar for anybody in the Title IX world, probably the HR world and the higher education world, for maybe even years. These changes have been going through. We've been talking about them. We thought they would be released, you know, possibly earlier than this. It was kind of dropped at the last second. But all these changes have been kind of known more or less. We thought maybe they would be revised or changed or whatever, but here we are today. We have to do something to stay in compliance with the law. I agree that we can oppose it and talk about it on the 21st to maybe have our attorney general on the behalf of our state and encourage them to join the lawsuit. But it affects K through 12 and higher education. So it's not just NSHE, not in our state. I think there are other places. So I'm not sure that NSHE should be the only entity that's opposing it. If we do as a board decide to, it might be better for state to oppose it. But today, I still think you have to approve these policies to keep us in compliance, to make sure that we eliminate any possible repercussions. We hear threats all the time coming out of the administration doing this and that. And unfortunately for us, that $400 million is something they control. There's not another person that can put that's in between them from removing that $400 million from us. And in the current place where we are, that would be absolutely devastating, especially for the next fiscal year coming up, if that was at jeopardy. So I think we have to approve the policies today. These are temporary policies that are going to be coming back through the audit committee for possible changes later on. And at the same time, we can pursue a litigation or encourage our attorney general for the state to do that on the state's behalf. But I think you have to approve something, you know, today. Thank you.
Chair DeBrava, can I just respond briefly?
Yes, please. Quickly, please.
So, Regent Carter, I understand your point on we pass this, but it's temporary so that we don't lose federal funding and then we can come back to it later in August. However, Z made a very good point. If this is passed, it is legally binding. It becomes our law. We are adopting that law. That was Z's direct quote, legally binding. So it is not a temporary, while it's on paper, it's not the law, we don't really have to do anything. It is legally binding if this body passes it. And I have one
correct.
Other recommendation.
Come to us. It's legally binding on us from the Guard of Education. It's already legally binding.
And I have one last recommendation. So you mentioned that we could pass it today, and then we could come back to it August 21st. However, one of the positive things to this body meeting very regularly these days with lots of things going on is we have a meeting August 13th, which is the day prior to this deadline. So what I'm recommending to this body is to not pass this today, and for Joe Reynolds and for the general counsel team to review opportunities for the Board of Regents and NSHE to join litigation, for that to be presented back to the Board of Regents, and for there to be a vote to join litigation on August 13th. It is not abnormal for things to be added to agendas last minute. This is a reasonable request. And that's what I'm requesting. It gives us more time to discuss litigation, which clearly I'm not the only one who's interested in hearing more about. It gives Joe more time to discuss with the Attorney General's office if it's something the state would want to do. And if they are not interested in doing, it's something for us to learn more and be presented with more information on what NSHE or institutions can do. So that's what I'm recommending. Chair, that's all I have.
That's Ms. Levine, to clarify, we don't have a meeting scheduled for August 13th. We have one scheduled for August 21. And that's why we're in that time predicament. Let me come back to you. Let me have Regent McAdoo, and then we have Nevada State College President Rantawa, and then Regent Geddes. Regent McAdoo.
Thank you, Chair DeBrava. I'm going to just start out with my very adamant statement. I am absolutely not siding with the oppressor by voting yes at this time. The accusation was offensive to me. I've spent my entire life and career supporting the oppressed and underserved. So I want that on public record. But I would like someone to clarify what steps can we take legally, if it's legally binding. I don't speak legal language all that well. So could someone please clarify the steps that we need to take? If we were to approve this today, I'm not in agreement with the federal changes, but I'm also really struggling with jeopardizing possibly federal funding for every student. It's not just about a small group of students, it's for many of our students. So what are the steps that we can take legally to either approve this for now and go into litigation, and are we going to be able to change that? I can't tell from all the conversation. I would really like for someone to just lay out the steps, knowing that it sounds like some of us may approve it with the intent of being able to do something else about it. So thank you.
And Regent McAdoo, maybe I could call on Deputy Bagala to answer a question, or Jill Reynolds.
This is Joe. I'll go first at this, Regent McAdoo. The steps, you know, that we would take in what hearing from the board is additional communication that I'd have with the Attorney General's office. And I want to be careful not to speak for them and speak on their behalf, but also coordinate and communicate with them, whether it is something that they have a interest in joining with us or on our behalf pursuing, or it is something that we take on our own initiative as the Board of Regents and INCHI, and would look at then intervening in the one of the active suits. We always have the discretion to file our own complaint, but my initial inclination would be to join an existing suit already commenced by another higher education institution or State Attorney General's office. So the first step would be is have additional conversations with the Attorney General's office on their views on that and some of their recommendations on that. It's a significant amount of legal work to do that, but would certainly want to learn more about that process and how we'd be able to do that.
I'm sorry, I've got the Attorney General on the phone and he's got something to say. Attorney General, you're on the line.
Well, Regent Levine, now I have to say, hold the phone here, okay? I'm chair of this meeting here, and I might say that was just a little bit out of bounds to call the Attorney General.
I didn't call him, please. Chair. He's on the phone and he called me. Attorney General,
well,
go ahead.
No, Ms. Levine, no, Regent Levine, no. And I'll ask the Attorney General. I will call on the Attorney General after I go through my list here.
Okay.
So I'm going to the Nevada State College Student Body President, Suman Randhawa. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Jabrava. It's Suman Randhawa here. I want to say, first off, thank you, Regents, and everyone for taking the time to give this the high importance that it deserves. I'm the student body president at Nevada State College, so I speak as not only as a woman, a student leader, a mother, and a survivor. I appreciate Ms. Levine's strong voice, and I echo Dom Hall, and I appreciate her for sharing such a vulnerable and personal story. So I've heard too many stories of victims who've never received the justice that they deserve, and their voice is unheard. So I strongly oppose this new policy. It jeopardizes not only our basic needs for safety, but also allows perpetrators to continue carrying out heinous acts. It is unfortunate that this is presented a week prior to having to make this decision, but it is an important decision to make. And fortunately, you do have an opportunity to do what's right. So I, once again, thank you for taking the time to do this. I really hope you do consider opposing this new policy being put in place.
Thank you for your comments. We are going to go to Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to say, in serving with this board and its members, I can guarantee that all 13 of us do not stand on the side of rapists, violent criminals, and assaulters. We have implemented policies for decades, trying to protect students, trying to protect employees, and trying to make sure that it is a safe learning environment. We have no choice but to implement these. As Regent Carter pointed out, this is federal law. And as Bhagali said, 99% of this is straight from the federal law, and we have to approve it. There's not a single institution that is not approving these rules right now. Many have filed lawsuits, states have filed lawsuits, but nobody has not adopted these policies, and we have to. In other words, we are putting $420 million of federal funds in jeopardy, and we have to do it now because these students are counting on federal financial aid, Pell Grants, loans, etc., to be able to attend school in the next couple of weeks. We cannot delay this. We have to approve this today. None of us stand on the side of assaulters, and I am offended by that accusation as well. And I strongly encourage us to join the lawsuit, and I would encourage us to have that on the 21st and bring that forward so that we can sue the Department of Education for these rules and try and get them overturned. But at this point, we have to adopt it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Regent Geddes. I'm going to have Maria close out the comments, and then I'm going to go to a roll call vote. Maria?
Aloha. Thank you. For the record, Maria de Saperi. I just wanted to address a couple of things that were stated. Regent Levine asked about, Regent Levine talked about the 1 in 5 on campuses who are sexually assaulted or face sexual harassment. And Regent Carvalho then asked if that was a current number. That is, in fact, a current number. Dominique Hall talked about that crisis of sexual assault or sexual harassment on our campuses. This is not a campus problem. This is a national, a worldwide problem. So yes, the numbers here are 1 in 5. The numbers on every college campus across America is 1 in 5. Unfortunately, the numbers for individuals, females, between the ages of 16 and 24 is 1 in 5, regardless of whether they ever step a foot on a college campus. That is the reality we live in. So yes, something has to be done. That said, doing nothing is not the answer that we need today. To put this off to even the 13th would be too little, too late. We need something to move on now. We've done the best that we could with the situation that we had. Yes, there are a lot of requirements in these new laws, but they are, in fact, the law. It is a requirement, regardless of whether or not we put it in our policy. It is the law of the land come the 14th of August. And so it is required by every person in this country, regardless of whether or not you're following the policy. The best we could do would be to capture that policy, capture that language, put it into our policy, and then do what we've done. Create that second process that offsets that, that gives these people, the victims, the people who need resources, that opportunity. Dominique Hall talked about how she almost dropped out her sophomore year. That's why we have that second process in this policy, so that we can reach out to those individuals. Regardless of what that Section D says, we still have the authority. We maintain that ability to reach out, provide resources, provide assistance, and yes, even provide justice without them having to face a cross-examination, without them having to go through these horrible, as some may describe, processes. That's what this policy does. By doing nothing, by not passing this, by not implementing this policy, what you're doing is leaving us, those individuals who are working in this area, with no way to help individuals who need the help, that or who need help. And so we need a tool.
You guys hold the tool in your hand. We need a tool, and we need it now so we can start implementing, so that we can do these town halls, so that we can put out letters to the campus, so that we can tell people what to expect and how to expect it, how they can get the help that they need. But we can't do that if we don't know how to do that. And we can only do that if you give us the tool that we need. This is that tool. You guys have it before you. We're happy to answer any questions about it. But, I mean, again, whether we do it or not, it's the law. And basically what we're arguing over is really just Section D, because Section D is the, it incorporates that federal law. But, again, it's incorporating federal law. It's the entire policy that gives us the tools that we need to do the right thing regardless of what happens with the Section D cases. So even if we have to dismiss as required by that law, we would have a catch-all so that we can reach out to those individuals and still offer them the assistance they need. We talk about safer campuses. This gives us the ability to make sure that our campuses are indeed safe.
Mr. Chairman, this is Attorney John Moran. Regent Moran, I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, I definitely am not thrilled with regards to the way that the information was presented itself relative to the Attorney General, but I would just ask your, Mr. Chairman, if you could give our top law enforcement officer, our Attorney General, an opportunity to speak at some point prior to us conjuring a motion.
And Regent Moran, he got off the line because I told him that Chair DeBrava took him off the agenda. But to echo your sentiment, when we talk about how this is the law of the land, we just had the Attorney General, the top law officer of our state, try to clarify his position.
I call the question.
And part of the reason is because...
Yeah. Come on, she's out of order. Come on.
Go ahead and do the vote, please, Dean.
And I was also just reminded that the federal funds...
Regent Levine, I'm going to ask you to please mute yourself. You're out of order.
The federal funds don't even get removed.
I don't want to man-speak, but I will have to if you continue to child-speak. So please stop.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's not necessary. Let's just try to get this back together for one quick moment. Mr. Chairman, I was just going to ask, is there a methodology that possibly we could try to get the Attorney General on the phone? Because, again, I think he would be trying to provide updated legal information that may assist us with making a final decision on this matter. Again, I would hate to, and I mean, I think he would give us the courtesy under the same circumstances.
Well, and Regent Moran, I appreciate your comment. Right now at this stage, I'm going to call for the vote, and we can certainly talk with the Attorney General at a future meeting, or if he wants to participate in public comment at the end of this meeting, I'm more than happy to include him. But let's go ahead and call the vote, please.
Regent Hayes?
Yes.
Regent Levine?
No.
Regent McAdoo?
Sorry, I was on mute. Yes.
Yeah. Regent McMichael?
No.
Regent Moran?
No.
Regent Page?
Yes.
Regent Perkins?
Yes.
Regent Trachuk?
Aye.
Regent Carter?
Yes.
Regent Carvalho?
Aye.
Vice Chair Del Carlo?
Aye.
Chair DeBrava?
Yes.
Regent Geddes?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
We will now take a 10-minute recess, and we'll reconvene at 11:25. Thank you. Okay, we're calling this meeting back to some order. Item 7, fiscal year 2020-2021 NC State Supported Operating Budget for possible action, Chancellor Riley and CFO Andrew Klinger. Chancellor Riley.
Thank you, Chair DeBrava. For this item, the fiscal year 2020-21 NC State Supported Operating Budget, We're asking the board to adopt the revised state funding for FY21, included in AB 3 of the 31st special session. The governor recommended $112.8 million in reductions, which would follow the recommendations of this board. And then AB 3 included an additional $25 million in reductions, bringing ENSHE's total operating budget reductions to $137.8 million. And this is just simply having the board adopt the outcome of the special session.
CFO Klinger, did you want to go over any of the information?
Chair DeBrava, for the record, Andrew Klinger, I think the chancellor highlighted it pretty well. I think the only thing I would add is just to emphasize that what the board is approving today is just the state general fund piece of the state operating budget. The Business Finance and Facilities Committee approves ENSHE's annual budget, including the state operating budget, and we still plan to bring the entire budget, but just wanted the board to approve the state portion. So that's all this action does today.
Thank you, CFO Klinger. And being on item 7, but I think Regent Trachok, and then I have, then we'll go to Regent Geddes after Regent Trachok.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that I understand exactly what it is we're voting on. This legislature has told us what the funding is going to be. There's nothing for us to approve. That is what it is. So I'm just sort of perplexed why we even have this matter as an action item rather than an information item. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Regent Trachok. Historically, the board has always approved the revised budget as an action item. To your point, yes, and we're just approving what the legislature has done, and we're going on record as a board just approving that there is a revised budget we're operating from.
Regent Geddes.
Move approval.
Second.
I have a second from Regent Perkins. Any other discussion? Seeing none, if we would have a roll call vote. I think Regent Carter has a question.
Just real quick. So I see special projects. Just for my edification, could you remind us what special projects includes?
Yeah, Chair DeBrava, for the record, Andrew Klinger to Regent Carter. So special projects is used to match federal funds so that the state gives us funding for that so that we can match federal programs that come through the EPSCoR. So I guess to elaborate on that, with the loss of state dollars, you do end up losing, obviously, the ability to leverage that into more federal dollars as well.
Thank you. Dean Gould, if you do a roll call vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regent Levine. I'm sorry, was that a yes? It's hard to hear.
Yes.
Thank you. Regent McAdoo.
Yes.
Regent McMichael.
Yes.
Regent Moran.
Yes.
Regent Page.
Aye.
Regent Perkins.
Aye.
Regent Trachok.
Aye.
Regent Carter.
Yes.
Regent Carvalho.
Aye.
Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Aye.
Chair DeBrava.
Yes.
Regent Geddes.
Aye.
Regent Hayes.
Yes.
Motion passes unanimously.
Thank you, Mr. Gould. We will move to item 8, proposals to comply with an additional $25 million reduction in fiscal year 2020-2021 state-supported operating budget, and it is listed for possible action. I just wanted to remind the board members that we may not have to take action depending on what discussion happens here. I'll turn it over to Chancellor Riley.
Thank you, Chair DeBrava. So the proposals to comply with the additional $25 million in reductions to the FY21 budget. As mentioned in the previous item, the legislature included an additional $25 million in budget cuts to NC state operating budgets. Because of the prudent fiscal policies, the board has adopted and followed. NC has been able to offset a large portion of the budget reductions with one-time funding. This has helped mitigate the impacts we have on students. The board has considered a series of revenue offsets from using the CARES dollars, from looking at our rainy day fund or the market fluctuation account, and then now considering looking at our ending fund balance or our operating budget and bringing that down to around 5%. So all these revenue offsets have really spared many of the deep cuts that we would have to make with faculty, staff, and our students. However, these one-time revenue offsets will not be available in FY22. So Chair DeBrava's recommendation to bring forward at the meeting on August 21st to look at, some deep discussions that many of you regents have been asking for will really prepare us for FY22, because even if we don't receive additional cuts, without these revenue offsets, you will not have that as a tool set any of the challenges that we're going to face in the future. So what is before you today and what is being proposed? And as Chair DeBrava said, I'm going to outline a couple options you might want to consider. CFO Klinger's here to talk about them further. We can continue this conversation and actually vote it on the 21st, but at least we'll put those out there as several recommendations going forward. So what is being proposed in the supplemental materials is to use $15 million of our operating reserve to reduce the cuts that would be necessary at each institution. The proposal includes the allocation of almost $302,000 from system administration to provide an additional offset to the reductions for GBC and Western Nevada College. However, even with that assistance, we still see challenges, particularly for Western Nevada College and GBC. Western Nevada College, about $230,000 in cuts, GBC about 163, but there's actually another 40,000 from the April meeting to bring them to about $200,000. In addition to the $15 million transfer from the operating reserves, there are other options the board can consider. And I just want to outline three other options real briefly. And this was some input that we received from regents about trying to minimize the impact of the $10 million in cut. And if we do the 15, then we're still dealing with the $10 million in cut to the each institutions. So one is the board could consider, instead of a $15 million transfer, is to look at a $39.5 million transfer from the operating reserve, which is the amount that would be necessary to eliminate any additional reductions at all our institutions. So CFO Klinger looked at that and said, what amount would he have to take from our reserve in order to mitigate any of the reductions at each of our institutions? The downside of this proposal is it would reduce our operating reserve to 3.2%, which is below our target of 4.5 to 5%. The state is aligned to keeping about 5% ending fund balance. We have always attempted to keep the same amount, about a 5%. So this would bring us down quite a bit to the 3.2. So the one option is we want to mitigate any is to take a larger portion of our operating reserve to offset that. The second option would be to take a $23.5 million distribution from our operating reserve, which would eliminate additional reductions for all of the institutions except for UNR, CSN, TMCC, and Nevada State College. albeit would be less than with a 50, you know, if we only did 15 million, but still there would be some reductions necessary for those institutions. This option would reduce our operating reserve to only to 4.9%, so it would keep us at 5%, which is not only in line with our target reserve, but is consistent, as I mentioned before, with the state's ending fund balance. Now, the bringing us to 4.9%, the reason for that is that we this additional distribution would be possible because when we used the June numbers versus the May, we experienced a $9 million increase from May to June. So before we were talking about a $50 million reserve. When we proposed the $15 million, we were using May numbers during the legislative session. When CFO Klinger looked at the June numbers, our actual reserves went up $9 million. So again, if we chose to use the 23.5%, we would still keep at the 5% reserve that we struggle for. So one option you might want to consider again now or at the 21st is the 39.5 to eliminate any reductions. The 23.5% keeps us at the 5% reserve and then mitigates a lot of those losses, except for those institutions that I just mentioned. But those losses would be less than if we only did the $15 million. And the final option the board could consider would be distributing the funds proportionate to the reductions to protect the smaller institutions like GBC and Western Nevada College. So you could look at the $400,000+ that are impacting Western Nevada College and GBC and just proportionally reduce that to, for everybody, or you could look at those unallocated dollars that are still available for and reduce it there. Now, again, the downside of that is then we would be taking from one institution to supplement the others. So these are three of the possible options that the board has in addition to what's being presented to you at the $15 million transfer. The last thing I'll just mention, too, is that we're in a little better position in June, as I mentioned, because we received about an increase of $9 million in our operating reserve, bringing it from 50 to 59. So with that, I'll stop and turn it over to CFO Klinger if he wanted to add anything, or are both available to answer any questions the board has. Thank you.
Chair DeBrava, for the record, Andrew Klinger, Chief Financial Officer. Really not a lot to add to what the Chancellor went through. The supplemental material does lay out various tables and six tables within there. But all of that information is based on the proposal of $15 million. I think if it was the will of the board to want to look at some of those other options, I think it would make sense to have me prepare similar material for those options and bring it back to August 1st. The Chancellor asked me if there was any rush to get this done today, and the answer is no. I mean, the state has taken their portion of our funds. Obviously, we have to solve this $25 million hole in our budget, but there is no urgency to do it today. And again, if it was the will of the board to look at those other options, I think it would be best to bring those back at a future meeting.
Thank you, CFO Klinger. Here's my list. I have Region Trachok, McAdoo, Perkins, Geddes, Carter, and then Region Page. If we start with Region Trachok, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's important for all of us to keep in mind that this is not cash sitting in a bank account. What we have in this, what we call this reserve fund, we have 22,000 discrete accounts from all of our institutions. UNLV is the largest holder, holding about 54% of this. And if we think of this as if we rented an apartment building, and we took from each of our tenants a security deposit, we take that security deposit and we put it in the bank. We can't spend that. Each of these 22,000 accounts are accounts that are for everything from repaving or resurfacing parking lots to air conditioning units on down the line. The when we're talking about this this account and that we have cash in this account, we don't have cash in this account. That is the unrealized gain on the approximately $800 million of these 22,000 discrete accounts that has been invested in long-term and in short-term investments. If the as a board, we could decide that the each of these accounts that actually sits with each of the institutions will be controlled by those institutions, or if we keep it as it is, so it's controlled by the system, even though the actual owner, not the legal owner, but the actual owner is each of those institutions. If we draw on this account, what we're doing is then we're selling positions in those long-term and short-term investments. So think of it this way. Let's say you bought Apple stock, and you bought Apple stock at $100 a share, and you had 10 shares of this. And today it's trading at $420. We have an unrealized gain of $320. That's not cash to us. We can take that gain by liquidating our position. The flip side to this is, as we saw in April, if the market crashes and those unrealized gains become unrealized losses. So as we liquidate the account, we're changing the holding in that account. And so this is not so simple that we put $50 million or $75 million cash in an account. That's not what we have. What we're dealing with is an unrealized gain, which, as I mentioned, could just as easily become an unrealized loss. And that's what we saw back in March and April when the market crashed. So I just ask everybody to keep this in mind when we're making these decisions here. Do you want to make the decision to liquidate positions now? Do we want to wait and liquidate those positions? And if we're going to be doing something like that, I would strongly advise that we reach out to our two OCIOs and get their advice on when we should do that. The if we should do that is based on the recommendations and the decision of this board. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Richard. CFO Klinger.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, may I just clarify one point that Regent Trachok made? And I think Regent Trachok did an excellent job of sort of describing what makes up this account and sort of how it works. The one clarification I would make, though, is that by allocating out of the operating reserve, and as Regent Trachok said, this represents unrealized gains in the market, but by distributing that to the campuses, you're not necessarily liquidating it at that point. Essentially, what you're doing is you're authorizing each of those institutions the ability to now go and expend those dollars. And so the liquidation, if you will, as Regent Trachok described, doesn't actually happen until they actually spend those dollars. So this would just authorize them to spend it. But obviously, they wouldn't spend those dollars in the course of a day. It would be spread out over time. So just wanted to sort of clarify that one piece.
Thank you. Regent McAdoo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in regard to Agenda Item 8, I first of all want to thank CFO Klinger, the Chancellor, the presidents, and the business officers from the institutions for their time and mental energy in creating the proposal that is before us today. So while I was reviewing that and more or less having the mindset of trying to mitigate, you know, the impact on each institution, because I personally believe that we have to continue to look at this from a system perspective and honestly can't just handpick an institution that we may have graduated from or have in our community or some keen likeness for some reason, because we do have a system and we serve the whole state. So it won't surprise you, I wrote out my notes, and in light of what Chancellor Riley shared, CFO Klinger shared, and Regent Trachok shared, I can tell by my notes that I speak a very simple language when it comes to investments and gains and losses. So realizing a bit of this could be a duplication of that, I haven't had time in the last few minutes to make sure I don't duplicate what they've said. But I did come up with two other options very similar to what the chancellor shared. And so we have, if you will, option A we have before us, which would be table 5 in the supplemental material we have. And option B, and I spoke at great length with CFO Klinger about this, you know, trying to make sure that I understood it and wasn't just coming up with something that I thought was good. So it seemed to me we could consider taking the whole $25 million right now, according to our material, we have $59.3 million in the reserve balance. So we could apply that $25 million to that $59.3 million straight across the board to all the institutions, which would mean then that no institution would have an additional budget reduction needed at this time for this $25 million. When I did the math, that came to $34.3 million, but I know we heard some different figures today. I assume those probably are more correct than mine because I just did simple arithmetic. Option C really would be a hybrid of option A and option B, in my opinion, because it would use the percent formula that is in option A, where one of our institutions has 54% and the others have different percentages. So it would use the percent rather than taking it right from the top. And to me, that means that using that percent formula, we have to take more than the $25 million out. Again, I calculated at about $37 million. The number given today was a little more than that. So I would admit I don't probably know the exact number, but close enough that we would know it would reduce that reserve account to somewhere in the $20 to $23 million. But what that would also mean on the hybrid part of option B is that no institution would have, they would have a zero balance in there. They wouldn't have to pay it. But then it also means those with the higher percentage would actually get money, a one-time distribution into their account. So I personally would like for us to have these options, or you know, the other options presented, I think they're all very similar, but with the accuracy that CFO Klinger would bring forth with the numbers for us to review and take action on it after all the discussion today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Regent McAdoo. And before I go to Regent Perkins, Dean Gould, if you wanted to clarify, if we were to not take action, you would actually prefer us to have a motion to postpone this and just put it on the 21st meeting. Is that correct? As opposed to just not doing anything?
I think that would be the most appropriate. I mean, you could take no action and then there's no action. It functionally has the same result. But if someone makes a motion to postpone this to the 21st, then everyone knows it will be on the 21st. It's more, you know, I was just trying to make it clear that it's not really a motion to table, because it's not like there's a motion on the table to table.
Okay.
So you can either do nothing or make a motion to postpone this matter to the 21st.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. We'll go to Regent Perkins. Regent McAdoo, go ahead.
I would actually like to make that motion to defer the action to August 21st, but still have the discussion today so that we can process some of the thinking about this. So I make the motion.
Thank you. Let me see if there's a second for that motion. Well, and Regent Page is a second. Now, that doesn't preclude us from continuing our conversation, and we just take the vote at the when we're done with this deliberation. So thank you, Regent McAdoo and Regent Page. I'll go to Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have thank you, Tom, for thank you, Chancellor Riley, for coming up with the alternative suggestions to solve this this budget. I hate to call it a crisis, but this budget dilemma. I guess my I was thinking out loud, and if we have to consider whether we're a system or whether we're individual institutions under an umbrella. I consider us a system, much like Regent McAdoo. We are all one system, and there's a minimum number of people that are necessary to run an institution. And no matter if you're the biggest institution or the smallest institution, you're all going to need. Everybody needs, like at the bare bones minimum, a financial aid person, regardless of how big or small your institution is. I say that to say this. The smaller institutions because they're operating so lean, what is a drop in the bucket for a larger institution is a tsunami for the smaller institutions. And that's just my personal thoughts about thinking about the system as a whole. I would feel really comfortable voting today because we don't know what the market is going to do next week or the week after. With the option to take the reserves down to 4.9 in the operating funds. And my question would be, is CFO Klinger comfortable with making that decision? Would that cause a panic? Is my question, actually. So CFO Klinger, if you could answer that for me, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair DeBrava, Andrew Klinger for the record, to Regent Perkins. There's a lot of things that cause me panic, but that would not be one of them. I think as the Chancellor outlined in his remarks, you know, taking the $23.5 million out, you know, while it doesn't ensure that all institutions don't have to make cuts, it does ensure that more institutions don't have to take cuts, including some of the smaller ones. And I think that part of the reason why that number was chosen is because that does take us right to, or just below that 5% level, which, as the Chancellor stated again, is consistent with what the state, uses as sort of their unobligated reserve that they maintain. So I am comfortable with that. You know, as I've stated before, there is always a risk. And as Regent Trachok said, if the markets go down and suddenly we have a loss like we did in March, you know, that could wipe all of this out in no time. But as of today, yes, I would be comfortable taking this down to 4.9%.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that answer. And I guess in closing, I think this would speak mountains to the legislators that we are trying to do our best to mitigate and lessen the effects on our institutions. Just as everybody else had to use their funds to draw it down to this low, we're reflecting that same sentiment about, you know, using our reserve funds to institutions' burden. Okay, I think that's everything. And thank you so much again for coming up with the other ideas and like the hybrids and thinking outside the box. I really, really appreciate that.
Thank you, Regent Perkins. Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple of comments and a question is, I know during the discussions in the legislature, at one point we were looking at $50 million, and I want to thank the Chancellor and Michael and CFO Klinger for getting us down to $25 million. But I believe one of the updates we saw was, you know, the $15 million allocation and the $10 million in cuts. That wasn't something that we were bound to by the legislature. It was just a suggestion to them of how we could do it. So if we go to this 23 level, that wouldn't be anything that would get us sideways with the legislature. Is that correct, Andrew? Or Tom?
If I could, yeah, for the record, Tom Riley, that's correct, Chair Geddes. We made it clear that, you know, we had a short period of time. We huddled together. We got our chair on the phone and said, yeah, that's our recommendation, but we would need to go back to the board for full approval. So that's totally in line if the board takes a different direction on that.
And Mr. Chairman, if I can add to that, Andrew Klinger for the record. And so we did have conversations, and in the spirit of transparency, I wanted to make sure that as they were making that decision, the legislature knew that this was one of the options we were going to consider. And at the time, obviously, we didn't know what the final numbers for June looked like. And what I had represented to them is that we would draw our reserves down to a 5% level consistent with theirs. And so that was something that they sort of understood. So I think the change is consistent because of the revised June numbers.
Thank you. And that's my second question is, I'm comfortable, as Regent Perkins was, in getting down to the 5% level or the 4.9, and it sounds like that's what you agreed to with the legislature. So if we do that 23 allocation and bring us to the 5, we're still in line, and we could help campuses, and we're doing what you said we would do in that regard. But to go beyond that to higher levels, that would make me uncomfortable to go below that 5% and to do distributions there. And just one other comment is, you know, we look at table 6 there, and we look at all of the COVID impact dollars that are sitting out there. And what is it, 76 million of estimated COVID impact? So any extra allocation that we can do to the campus, I think, would be helpful in helping them address all those. At one point, I heard we might look at reallocating from the campuses who get more to the campuses who don't get as much out of the percentage. And I'd be uncomfortable with that based on seeing the 76 million and how every campus has a lot to deal with. And I wouldn't want to take away from, UNLV's allocation, give it to the other campuses because they're sitting there staring at 30 million in impact. So just the comment there. And since we have a motion to delay this to the 21st, you'll have the July 30th numbers for us for that one, Andrew?
Mr. Chairman, Andrew Klinger, for the record, to Regent Geddes, we typically get those numbers right around the 21st, 22nd. So I was actually thinking that earlier. So we may have those numbers, but I may literally just have them right before the meeting.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Regent Carter, then Regent Page.
So I have quite a few questions, Mr. Chair. So if I get long-winded, you can maybe come back to me. But I'll start with a couple things. So we talked about, you know, GBC and WNC as kind of being our smallest places. But if we look on Table 5 there, actually the institution that still got the most to cut there is actually Nevada State College. We need to keep them in our thoughts as well. I would really like to hear from our investment advisors on the 21st if we are delaying this. I think it'd be incredibly critical to hear what their opinion is on selling in this particular time. We pay them a good deal of commission to get their opinion, so I think we should definitely use that opinion. My next thing, we talked about system projects in the last agenda item. I think that now is under other non-formula accounts on this particular table. Is that correct?
CFO Klinger, for the record, that is correct. I was just trying to roll them up and simplify them a little bit.
Sure. So by cutting that, are there active grants right now that we are not able to match? So we're essentially eliminating $2 for every dollar that we're cutting here, or is that just potential stuff we could match?
At this point in time, that is just potential stuff that we could match. So there's not grants that we're losing as a result of this.
Okay. On table 6, the amount of distribution from the pool, are the amounts calculated on like a daily average, monthly average, weekly average, or just a point in time?
The distributions, and we did this when we did the same, we used the same methodology when we did the market fluctuation account and same methodology here. So it is the average, what's calculated here is the average daily balance for the month of June. And I believe when we did the market fluctuation account, I can't remember if we used the average daily balances for the month of May or April, but we used the same methodology.
Okay, so that would be reproducible. It's not something abstract. Something that we can, somebody else could look at the numbers and come up with the same number.
That's correct.
Okay. I had a classified employee email me with a little bit of concern because obviously at some of the institutions there's going to be layoffs, and contractually it seems like the classified employees are less protected from layoffs than our faculty and some other groups. So is that a point of consideration for the committee or concern from our, maybe our institutional president that, you know, hey, I'm at GBC and maybe I have one person for this particular unit and I've got to make a cut, but I can't cut faculty or administrative faculty or whatever that might be because of other contractual, you know, issues. I'm not sure if that's a particular issue yet, but maybe that would be something we could also talk about the 21st, unless the chair would like to solicit some comments from the presidents today.
You know, Regent Carter, I might hold off until the 21st to see these different proposals on paper from CFO Klinger and the chancellor. And then at that time, we'll also, like I had mentioned, bringing the potential of this committee, a special committee that the board would have to weigh in on to decide if they wanted to go in that route with the committee. So let's hold that till the 21st.
Now my final thought then, so there's some COVID workforce dollars definitely making their way through the process, wherever that process is. And so there still may be some community college numbers that fluctuate. I'm not sure what, you know, if those dollars offset existing dollars, if they're new dollars, or how that would be allocated. But I know that that money is also funneling through. So if we could update the sheet for the 21st, if these numbers from the workforce development COVID money also comes through. I think that's it for now for me.
Thank you, Regent Carter. I have Regent Page, then Regent Carvalho, and then Regent Hayes. Regent Page.
Thank you, Chair DeBrava. A question around the account. So if it's unrealized gains, I'm assuming then that the account could go negative with unrealized losses?
Chair DeBrava, for the record, CFO Klinger, that is correct. And in fact, during the Great Recession, you did see that happen in this account, because this account is basically capturing those gains and losses every month. And so during the Great Recession, you actually did see that account go into the negative for a while. And when that happens, obviously, you're not doing these monthly distributions anymore.
Okay. And then the second question around this is, I'm not as comfortable if we're going to make a distribution that we wait. Okay, because then we, just like we saw the difference of the $9 million gain, is quick as it goes up, it goes down quicker. And so we have that risk of, if we did approve, at the point that we approve it, of not selling those assets, and it's kind of a little bit of a gamble of where those prices go. And then my last point is, and I understand the reserves, but we have thrown out of the conversation again cost-saving measures. And we talked before about the business centers, and that's kind of been put on the back burner, and SCS. And I would like to see those still come forward no matter what. Even if we make these distributions, I still think we need to see where we can be more efficient going forward. And I do like the idea of the chair's committee, and that's all on my end. Thanks.
Thank you, Regent Page. Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, most of what I wanted to say has been said already, but I would echo my colleagues' comments regarding the fact that we are a system, and in times like this, we need to take that into consideration. I would also strongly encourage staff to seek the advice of the OCIOs. I think that, like Regent Carter said, we pay them, and Regent Trachok also. So we should engage them in their expertise, and I think this is a perfect situation to get their opinion.
And I would also like to know where we are with the workforce development CARES funds. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Carvalho. I have Regent Hayes, then Regent Levine. Regent Hayes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I would just like to caution the board, if we take this up again in a couple weeks, that it sounds very nice that, oh, we can dip further into our reserve accounts and everyone is going to be held harmless this year. No one's going to lose anything. We're talking about 2021. These cuts are also going to affect us in 2022. We've had some one-time CARES Act money. We've had some, we pulled down the money from the other account. We've done some one-time tricks that are helping us to survive the current fiscal year. If we were to pull 50 or 60 million, as was mentioned, in order that no one has to make any cuts, they're just going to be big cuts the next year without that money here. And I just think that's the wrong direction to go. Should we get down to the 5%, as Mr. Quinger said, was discussed with the legislature and is in line with what others do? I think that's appropriate. I think going beyond that is very dangerous because we don't know what 2022 is going to look like. There's a lot of folks saying the economy is going to get much worse. And what we think is getting us down to a 5 or 4.9 or 4.7% reserve, if the market dips suddenly, could all of a sudden be, as I think in Regent Page's questioning came up, a negative reserve. So let's not just think that there's this big pot of money that we can fix all the problems, because those problems will be here next year. I won't be here next year, but you guys will have to deal with those problems next year. Second is, I am absolutely opposed to taking any money that is put in by one campus and giving it to another. I don't think the solution to our problems is to say that one campus has too much money that they need to share with other campuses. I don't think that's the way to solve this problem. And then finally, I agree with Regent Carter. I think in talking to some of the presidents, it's become very clear that we may need to address our handbook that has, basically to lay off or terminate an administrative faculty member takes a year. Faculty members obviously are teaching classes and they have the same protections, but you can't eliminate a faculty member in the middle of teaching classes. And they also generate the revenue. So that leaves our classified staff particularly vulnerable, and they are instrumental in the operations of our campuses. I think we need to look at how we address administrative faculty. You know, we looked at this a few years ago and made some slight tweaks to it, but I don't think we went far enough. The arguments for having the long period for faculty members, they're mostly hired in the summers and start on academic years. That makes sense. But our administrative faculty, they're accountants and lawyers and other professionals that, you know, we've got jobs posted for them any time of year. These aren't jobs that if they were terminated, they would all of a sudden not be able to find employment for several months. I think we need to revise that. I can think of no other organization in the world that it takes a year to terminate someone. And then it puts a very heavy burden on our classified staff and the important functions that they serve. So I'd love to see that put onto our next agenda. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Regent Hayes. I have Regent Levine and Regent McAdoo. Regent Levine.
Thank you, Chair. First, I just want to say thank you to Andrew Klinger and the Chancellor for putting together this proposal. I'm planning on supporting it when that time comes in a few minutes, so thank you for that. I do want to just also mention I'm grateful to hear more of my colleagues on the board and their understanding of the financial times we're in. This is kind of the first meeting that I've really heard some of my colleagues better understand that, so I'm glad that's evolved. Trevor Hayes, I'm glad to hear that you understand that there are going to be cuts probably in the future due to the economic times, which is why it's probably not a good idea to attack the purse strings, which is our state legislature. But I also just want to advise this board one other thing. You know, we heard from Chair DeBrava earlier about how there's going to be a subcommittee that's formed out of August 21st to better look at how these cuts are made and more long-term sustainability that we should be considering. One thing we haven't heard is who gets to be on that subcommittee, how they're chosen, who chooses them, how many people will be on it, if there'll be enough regents that it'll be participating in open meeting law, or if it's going to be one of these backroom closed deals that not many people from the public will be able to participate in. I think procedurally, it's very important that we understand the structure of that subcommittee, how it'll be created, and who will be able to be on it. Furthermore, if people can't be on it, will they be able to be heard? Like I said, will it be open meeting law for them to be streamed? Will students and faculty be able to participate? Will there be public opinion that are opportunities for us to hear from the community? All of that is very important, and I think promotes transparency, which is something I know all of us want to do. And so I'd like to hear more of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Levine. We'll go to Regent McAdoo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I hear great interest in taking the reserve down to 4.9 to 5%. If I could ask CFO Klinger, if we could have then the reduction, additional reduction amounts from each campus before, really before there's even a motion or a vote on that, if he is prepared to give that to us, not intending to put him on the spot, because I'm, but can I ask for that, please? Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, CFO Klinger for the record. So I do have those numbers. I apologize they're not in your packet, but this was obviously a last minute adjustment that we were looking at. So the allocation methodology that I've calculated would be the same. Instead of 15 million, it would be 23.5 million. And under that methodology, system administration would reallocate 575,000 of its allocation to GBC and WNC. So if you look at the impact of that decision by campus, and so I'll just start at the top and go down. So UNLV in total would have excess funds distributed to them in the amount of $3.4 million. So again, it would offset all of these additional cuts, and then they would have $3.4 million above that. UNR would be required to make cuts after this distribution of 23.5 million. They would still be required to cut their budget approximately 2.4 million. The College of Southern Nevada would still need to reduce their budget by 1.7 million. Truckee Meadows Community College would still have a reduction of 398,000. And Nevada State College would have a reduction of 388,000. I should also point out the non-teaching institutions. So System Computing Center would still have a $680,000 reduction, and the other non-formula accounts would still be required to reduce their budgets $153,000.
Thank you so much. I got those written down. I appreciate that.
Was that all for Regent McAdoo?
I would just say I am not a bit surprised that CFO Klinger was prepared with those numbers. I find him do a very great job for us. Thank you.
Thank you. So we do have a motion on the floor for postponing any action until August 21st. Dean Gould, is that correct? Is that your understanding of the motion?
Yes, that is correct.
If you go ahead with the roll call vote, please.
Regent McAdoo?
Well, I was just going to ask if I could even rescind the motion after we were able to get those figures, but I'll just vote no on my own motion. Thank you.
Okay. Regent McMichael?
Yes.
Regent Moran. Regent Page.
Yes.
Regent Perkins.
No.
Regent Trachuk.
Aye.
Regent Carter.
Yes.
Regent Carvalho. Is that an aye? It's hard to hear. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, yes, that's aye.
Thank you. Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Aye.
Chair Dubrava.
Yes.
Regent Geddes.
Aye.
Regent Hayes.
Yes.
Regent Levine.
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Chief Staff Gould. We will move to item 9, 2021-23 biennial operating budget. We're going to go to Chancellor Riley, please.
Thank you, Chair DeBrava. Not a lot to report on this, but we are engaged in conversations with a governor's finance office in preparation for the budget, the biennial budget. I think it's safe to say there won't be a lot of enhancements. We're working to look at our base budget plus caseload growth, and we are in discussions with them perhaps around two or three possible enhancements based upon our discussions with the board previously and our visits to each of the campuses. One of the areas that we're in discussion with the governor's office is regarding the 64% COLA funding, which currently, if it's in the next biennial budget, would be a concern. So we're working to look at to moving that back up to the 80%. We hope to have further direction from them in the next week or so. And if not, then we would be recommending on the 21st that this be your number one priority going into the legislature, as we have had several legislators saying that this should be a discussion that we can have, a policy discussion at the legislature. As far as the other enhancements that we would be in, we're in discussion with the governor's office, would be twofold. One would be the academic advising. You know, during our visits with the campus, during our discussions during the budget, this rose as, you know, the top uniform recommendation across all institutions. We could make a strong argument that our cuts have impacted our advising ratio. This board has taken action to set a rate advising, and we know that advising is clearly linked to student success. I think that's a very straightforward argument and proposal, and something that we've already discussed with this board. If we can even get another enhancement in, it would probably be our recommendation for you to consider on the 21st is to include the capacity enhancements right at the community colleges, that we should be on record asking for continuation of that. So a lot just depends what direction we get from the governor's office. You know, in the past, we were kind of given a dollar figure. You know, last biennium was $120 million. But because of the pandemic and because of the real challenges with the budget, we're just talking specific projects with the governor's office. And that concludes the report. I'm available, or CFO Klinger is available if you have any questions.
Thank you, Chancellor Riley. Just a pause here for a moment. Any questions for the Chancellor or for CFO Klinger? Seeing none, that was information only. We are now item 10, new business. Currently seeing no new business, we are going to public
comment. Sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I couldn't get my text in fast enough.
Jeopardy.
Sorry, Mr.
So, all right. Well, Regent Perkins, go ahead for new business.
Okay. Let me start off. We made some decisions about our budgeting. Does this include the HEPI increase that will come in this semester? And if possible, can we delay that due to COVID and a lot of people being out of a job? I would also like to take into account what Regent Hayes said about changing our code to allow greater latitude and freedom to and options about when we lay off individuals. And can we look at a buyout in the service credit model? And once again, as I say all the time about the consolidation and shared services, let's take a look at that, but you've already addressed that. And that, lastly, granting, can we take a look at granting
institutional to out-of-state tuition waivers for veterans so that they can attend our school no matter where they are, or Nevada public institutions no matter where they are. And that is all that I have for new business.
Thank you, Regent Perkins. Regent Carvalho, new business.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few items that I'd like to put on new business if possible. Number one would be to place on the next agenda at least a discussion to commence a lawsuit or to join a lawsuit against Title IX. Number two, I would like to get an update from staff at the Schools of Medicine regarding how Senate Bill 4 regarding COVID-19 liability affects our medical students working in clinics and hospitals. And number three, I would like to ask for the board to consider a discussion, and this may be something on this new task force that, Mr. Chair, you've discussed today, about freezing tuition increases for at least the 21-22 school year. I don't know if it's a possibility, but I'd like to always keep students front and center in things that we do, and I know a lot of other schools around the country have done this. So thank you.
Thank you, Regent Carvalho. We are now going to public comment, and I believe we have Attorney General Ford on the phone.
Hi, yes, you do. This is Attorney General Aaron Ford. Thank you for allowing me to call in during public comment. Let me first indicate that my only interest in reaching out initially was to respond what I thought to was a specific question from, I believe it was Regent Carter, as to why my administration had not joined a lawsuit on the Title IX litigation. So it wasn't for any other reason but to offer an answer to him in that regard. And I'll back up to say this. Every time I hear a Title IX issue creep up, my ears perk because my dissertation topic for my PhD was related to Title IX. So as early as last January 2019, weeks after I'd been inaugurated, one of the first things that my office did was to sign on to a multi-state comment letter opposing the then-pending regulation changes. And over the next several months, we followed the progression of the rules, and we communicated with other state councils, state council occasionally, as to the status of the new rules. We were contacted by lead counsel in Pennsylvania regarding joining a multi-state suit, and we received a draft complaint and a request for a declaration in support of Nevada's participation in late May of 2020. Now, what we do, my office, when we get requests for multi-state participation in litigation is we don't make these decisions in a vacuum. We always reach out to the to any interested or potentially implicated governmental agency or entity so that we can ascertain if there's an interest in us joining, and if we were to join, if it would have a negative impact on any of their operations. And so, consistent with our practice, we reached out to our contacts at NSHE that particular that same week, seeking a response as to the interest in joining the lawsuit. And information included in the required declaration from Nevada in support of its participation in the suit. We didn't receive a definitive response from NSHE about interest in and the ability to gather information from the suit before the multi-state deadline for filing in early June. And frankly, given NSHE's own previous comment letter, which outlined a much more moderate position than taking in the multi-state lawsuit on the rules, and given the lack of definitive response and interest in the joining the lawsuit, as well as the lack of information available at the time to include it in a declaration, we were unable to join the lawsuit. To be sure, there was a lot going on around that time. We all know that COVID was hot and heavy, and there were many opportunities for things to not move as smoothly as possible. We were unable to, in June at that point, to join the lawsuit. That said, our office remains interested in opposing the rules as we have from the beginning and is available to facilitate intervention in any of the ongoing multi-states or even potentially file a separate lawsuit. But again, my comments were simply to respond directly to the question that I believe it was Regent Carter had raised, which is he didn't know why the Attorney General's office didn't file a lawsuit. So hopefully I've given you the context and the answer for that particular question. And again, my office remains, as it always is, available to you all relative to being able to file multi-state lawsuits and particularly on this issue. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will yield the floor back to you.
Thank you, Attorney General Ford. Is there any other public comment, Mr. Gould?
Mr. Chair, yes. We have one voicemail that came in, and then I have two emails that came in. So if I could ask Harry and SCS, are they ready to play that voicemail, please?
Hello. My name is Joshua Zerbel, Joshua Zerbel. And I am a current undergraduate at UNLV. During the last Board of Regents special meeting, I submitted a public comment in regards to an issue the upper administration is failing to address. To my surprise, Regent Lisa Levine reached out and helped me make the appropriate connections with upper administration at UNLV. I was hoping through email correspondence I could convey how important this issue is and action will be taken to protect students from further financial burden during these trying times. Instead, what I encountered was an example of how disconnected UNLV upper administration is from the reality of the university. One such expectation was the notion that whenever an undergraduate registers for a course, all additional fees associated will be outlined in the registration notes. Since I have been enrolled in the spring of 2018, I have never encountered any additional fees like third-party homework platforms outlined under the registration notes. As well, I guarantee if you ask any other undergraduate, they will say the same thing. This is an issue that needs to be investigated as to find the disconnect, especially considering it is legal under the Higher Education Act to ask students to pay any additional fees that are not disclosed at the time of registration. Thank you for your time.
Okay, and then Mr. Chair, if you'll bear with me, the other two came in. I have to read them from my laptop since I don't have the ability to print during the meeting. So I'll just read them. The first one came in from Julie, I think it's Mejia or Mejia, M-E-J-I-A. Agenda item 6 not only oppresses survivors of sexual assault or harassment, it's also an insult to force survivors to provide connecting documentation in reference to and instead of or, and by changing the language of this law allows and enhances the continuation of underhanding and underserving survivors. Agenda 6 is absolutely disgusting. The next one, and I think the last one, is from Nicole Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S. Greetings, my name is Nicole Thomas, and I am a graduate student at UNLV. I am the GPSA secretary, as well as the graduate assistant for the undergraduate student government, CSUN. I wanted to submit public comment today because, frankly, I am appalled by the actions and comments of the members of the board. Hearing a regent speak badly about a fellow regent while on recess is quite embarrassing and disheartening. Throughout this entire meeting, we have had student testimony against enacting this legislation that clearly strips the rights of sexual assault victims. I understand that it is federal law. I understand that state funding may be in jeopardy. However, I cannot in good conscience support a bad law. Time and time again, students hear, quote, well, we may not like this, we may not agree with this, but it is federal law, close quote. We can instead follow in the footsteps of several other universities and postpone this vote and await the results of an injunction that is already a pending lawsuit at the national level. Several states, including California and New Jersey, have not adopted these changes yet, and they are actively participating in a lawsuit against the Department of Education. By voting in support of these changes, you are implying that the government is essentially holding us hostage and setting a precedent that any laws, no matter how egregious, must be passed by this board simply because they are laws, and we are concerned about the possibility of losing funding. I am disappointed by the attacks lodged at Regent Levine throughout this entire meeting. I feel that she was one of the only regents to truly have the students' well-being at the forefront of her mind. I wanted to publicly thank Levine for her justified anger concerning this item and for supporting thousands of students whose voices could not be heard today. I respectfully ask that you reconsider these changes to Title IX and actively participate in the federal lawsuit to challenge these changes. Thank you. And with that, that is all the public comment I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chief Staff Gould. Seeing no other public comment, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everybody.